Gonna rise up, take what's there, 'cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Yeah, I voted."
This week in radical history for the week starting February 16th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
In 1950, this day saw the swearing-in of Fidel Castro as Cuba's first post-revolutionary prime minister. Castro, a Cuban native from an affluent family, had opposed the regime of the U.S.-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista, who seized power in a coup in 1951. Castro made several unsuccessful attempts to launch the revolution, and at one point his forces had dwindled to just 9 men, including Argentine Marxist Ernesto Che Guevara. They hid in the Sierra Maestra Mountains, Castro's old childhood stomping ground, and fomented rebellion among the peasant class, based largely on the promise of land reform. Soon after taking charge, Castro nationalized a number of Cuba's assets, which had been held by U.S. companies. This and the long-promised land reform measures Castro implemented moved many of the island's wealthier families to emigrate to the U.S. And in 1961, the CIA, under the Kennedy administration, financed a mercenary army of Cuban exiles to invade the island and resume the previous dictatorship. The effort failed and became a national embarrassment for the Kennedy administration. It also led to the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, wherein the Soviet Union installed a number of missile bases in Cuba as a deterrent to future invasion attempts by the U.S. And according to a number of sources, today marked the first documented instance of U.S. military advisors taking part directly in combat operations in El Salvador. In reality, the U.S. military advisors had been directing the Salvadoran government's counterinsurgency war against the FMLN, El Salvador's democratic leftist guerrilla organization. During the Iran-Contra hearings in 1987, the combat role of U.S. military personnel in El Salvador was discussed, and several years before that, a number of advisors were killed while flying reconnaissance missions to pinpoint rebel encampments for airstrikes. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, February 16th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
This week in radical history for February 17th, 1933, reports of 2 weeks of violence against labor unions and leaders make its way back to the United States, and coverage of Nazi concentration camps appear in magazines such as the AIZ in 1933. This publicly available information did nothing to dampen the enthusiasm of Hitler's financial supporters or the press agents in Europe and the United States, such as Henry Ford. Meanwhile, real journalists like George Selds, who documented the ties between American companies and Nazis, were suppressed. His stories were censored by U.S. press, and his 170,000 subscriber newsletters was driven out of business by J. Edgar Hoover's America's Secret Police, the FBI. Also on February 17, 1940 in Canada, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman suffers a severe stroke which leaves her paralyzed on the right side and unable to speak. She's rushed to the hospital where she remains for 6 weeks. After growing up in the United States, Emma would be deported by the government during the Red Scare years. Emma was banned from the country, called the Land of the Free, since 1931. Emma would die on May 14, 1940 in Toronto, Canada, her death finally allowing her visa back in the United States, where she was buried in Waldheim Cemetery next to the Haymarket Martyrs in Chicago suburb. Anti-anarchist law continued to be used to prevent certain people from entering the United States, as question number 25 on the intake form at Ellis Island asks, "Are you an anarchist?" which would automatically disqualify you from entering the United States.
On this day, February 17th, in 1975, 2 years before the famous anti-nuclear protest and occupation of the Seabrook nuclear power plant construction site in New Hampshire, more than 20,000 protesters in Germany occupied the proposed site of another nuclear power plant in Weil, Germany, near the Rhine River. Unlike the Seabrook protest, the German occupiers, who were far greater in number, resisted police attempts to arrest them and maintained effective control of the location for a number of months. The German authorities abandoned the construction plans as a result, whereas at Seabrook, the nuclear power plant there was eventually built. Some 20 years later, the Weil site was made into a nature preserve, thus protecting sensitive wetlands that would have been destroyed had the nuclear facility been built. And on this day in 1982, another massacre of civilians in the El Quiche region of Guatemala was carried out by the armed forces under the command of U.S.-backed Guatemalan dictator José Efrén Ríos Montt. Over a period of several years, more than 600 massacres were carried out against the mostly Mayan population of El Quiche by the Ríos Montt regime as part of a strategy to break the will of the Guatemalan resistance movement. Ríos Montt was a graduate of the infamous School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, where Latin American military personnel are trained in so-called counterinsurgency techniques, including torture, sabotage, and, as Ríos Montt demonstrated, the mass murder of innocent civilians. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, February 17th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
This Week in Radical History for February 18th, 1851, United States. A crowd of Boston blacks break into federal prison, rescue Frederick Jenkins, a southern slave jailed under the terms of the Fugitive Slave Act, and spirit him away to freedom in Canada. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 made any federal marshal or any other official who did not arrest an alleged runaway slave liable for a fine up to $1,000. Law enforcement officials anywhere now had the duty to arrest anyone suspected of being a runaway slave on no more evidence than the complainant's sworn testimony of ownership. The suspected slave could not even ask for a jury trial to testify in his or her own behalf. In addition, any person aiding a runaway slave or by providing food or shelter was subject to 6 months imprisonment and also a $1,000 fine. Officers who captured a fugitive slave were entitled to a bonus for their work as well. Slave owners only needed to supply an affidavit to the federal marshal to capture an escaped slave. Since any suspect slave was not eligible for trial, this led to many free blacks being conscripted into slavery as they had no rights in courts and could not defend themselves against any accusations. Lastly, for February 18th, 1861, Apaho and Cheyenne are forced to cede most of eastern Colorado, land guaranteeing them, quote, forever, unquote, in a treaty signed 10 years earlier. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 19th, in 1942, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. These four little numbers sentenced some 120,000 people of Japanese descent to a harsh life in American concentration camps. Apparently, because of Pearl Harbor, all persons of Japanese descent were potential spies. More than two-thirds of those who were captured were American citizens, and at least half of them were children. By the end of World War II, only 10 people were actually convicted of spying for Japan, all of whom were white. Talk about racial profiling. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
This Week in Radical History for February 20th, 1895, Frederick Douglass, escaped slave, anti-slavery leader, and advisor to Lincoln, dies at age 78. In 1875 address, Douglass proclaimed, quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want an ocean without its awful roar and its many waters. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will." Unquote. Also on February 20th, 1941, Buffy St. Marie, folk singer born on a reservation in Canada, she wrote this popular protest song in 1964, Universal Soldier.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill me for you, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan. and he thinks we're putting an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy and fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the walls. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon to a war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. He is the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. But his orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
Speaking about war and soldiers, on February 20th, on this date in 2005, Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson dies at age 67 by suicide. A couple months previous, he wrote, quote, "We had become the Nazi monster in the eyes of the whole world, a nation of bullies and bastards who would rather kill than live peacefully. We are not just horrors of power and oil, but killer horrors with hate and fear in our hearts. We are human scum, and that's how history will judge us. No redeeming social value, just horrors," unquote. Hunter S. Thompson. People, the
time. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 21st, in 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated. He was just about to deliver a speech in the Audubon Ballroom in Manhattan when a man came forward from the crowd, shooting him in the chest with a shotgun. Malcolm X was a powerful civil rights and human rights leader in America who associated himself with the Nation of Islam until right before his death. While some believe that the Nation of Islam was behind his assassination, Malcolm X's radical race politics definitely intimidated a number of people. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it.
Also on February 21st, 1972, the Harrisburg Seven. This was a group of religious anti-war activists. Six of the seven were Irish Catholic nuns and priests. They were charged with attempting to kidnap National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger and planning to blow up some steam tunnels. The trial would end in a hung jury, and all would be eventually released. People, the
this is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 22nd, in 1879, F.W. Woolworth opened his very first five-and-dime store in Utica, New York. As the Woolworth Company spread, the stores began to incorporate lunch counters, serving food and drinks to the public. In the South, segregated Woolworth lunch counters became very significant in the civil rights movement. The Greensboro sit-in in 1960, which took place at a Woolworth lunch counter, ignited a huge movement of sit-ins and boycotts all over the South. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Ali Abu Nima is a second-generation Palestinian journalist and the founder and the driving force of the Electronic Intifada. He is one of the strongest proponents of the one-state solution and the BDS movement, and a prolific Palestinian voice speaking throughout the world. This morning we feature a presentation he gave at Bowdoin University as a guest of the student group Students for Justice in Palestine. It will take our entire time, so let's get right to it. Here is Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima speaking at Bowdoin University.
Thank you, Simon, and good evening, everyone. And I want to thank Bowdoin Students for Justice in Palestine for making my visit here possible. And I want to thank also all the co-sponsors for supporting this this event. And my talk tonight is only the tip of the iceberg, because since I got here yesterday, I've been enjoying the excellent food at the dining hall and many conversations with many of the students here. I'm very loath for that to come to an end. It's been a lot of fun. We had a semi-democratic process, sort of an informal democratic process, about how I should approach this talk, because I could come here and give you a lecture. I promise I'm not going to read this. And with no problem at all, but I really wanted to hear from students what they thought would be a useful approach in terms of advancing their mission, which we just heard, of educating the campus, and also perhaps in recognition that not everybody comes to this issue with the same level of knowledge or commitment or background. So what I decided to do is to talk quite informally and hopefully to have as much beautiful and intimate room, have as much time for us to have a discussion as possible. Although there are a few points I definitely want to touch on. Now, since I've been on campus and walked around this really beautiful and lovely place, I've noticed doesn't make Bowdoin unique. But there are a lot of statues and chiseled names and paintings in the hallways. And I think every single one of them I've seen has been the statue or the name or the image of a white man. And they tend to have very grim faces, too. I mean, they very rarely smile. And now that's not something that's makes Bowdoin stand out. But it is a feature of the way our country's history is told, and to a great extent how our present is and future is told. I recently started rewatching, since now you can get everything on your iPad pretty much for free, rewatching old episodes of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Who watches that? Good. All right. And which I love, and I've always loved it. But you know, you look at it with a different eye. And one thing that struck me how depressing it was that in the 2360s, that you know, Starfleet is still run by the same white men whose paintings are on the walls in Bowdoin. Now, the reason I mention this is that I hope that that's something people can identify with, that obviously history is might have been written by many white men, and no wonder they're the star players. But we know that history was, in fact, and is made by women and by people of very diverse backgrounds. And that it has been a struggle to recognize that. That's not something that has been given up easily. People have had to fight for that kind of recognition and for the proper place that everybody ought to have in our collective history. But it's also a very good analogy for how the question of Palestine has been talked about and spoken about, particularly in the United States, where there really has been one very dominant narrative, which many of us can probably recite by heart. And it's a narrative that has, unfortunately, written the Palestinians out of history. It's a narrative that has reduced the Palestinians to a role that is assigned for them as either terrorists or savages or interlopers, or, and this was really a feature of the last presidential election cycle in this country, where a number of Republican candidates were competing with each other to say that the Palestinians are an invented people. Now, those of you who study history and literary theory and critical theory and so on can understand that, you know, everyone, all peoples are invented in the sense that, people aren't born with a given story. That story has to be applied to them in a way. But singling out Palestinians this way by saying Palestinians are an invented people is a way to delegitimize them even further and to say that, in fact, you shouldn't pay attention to them. They don't exist. Their claims are insignificant and so on. So it's very hard for me to imagine another group of people in this country, another collective, being spoken about in that way in such mainstream discourse in the early 21st century. So for me, Palestine is very personal. I can tell you a little bit about my own personal connection to Palestine. Both of my parents were born in Palestine. My mother in a small village called Lifta, which is near Jerusalem, and my father in a village called Batir near Bethlehem, also not far from Jerusalem. And there's very little that's extraordinary about that. Many Palestinians have very similar backgrounds. It's very typical. My mother's village still exists. You can go and see the houses if you can get to Jerusalem. It's one of the few villages which Palestinians were forced to leave in 1948 where most of the houses are intact, and you have these beautiful examples of very old, sometimes hundreds of years old, vernacular architecture of that part of the world where people lived. And there's a struggle over Lifta now. It's even been in the news recently. There have been stories about it because I mentioned other villages. Most of the others were systematically destroyed after 1948, after Palestinians were forced to leave. Many of them were dynamited or bulldozed and then planted over with forests by the Jewish National Fund in order to essentially conceal the traces of where the Palestinian people had been. Lifta is one of the exceptions. And today I think it really symbolizes, in a sense, the whole struggle over Palestine. There are people from Lifta. My mother is one of them, but there are people from Lifta all over the world. There's in the Chicago area where I live, there is something called the Lifta Association, where many people from Lifta, gather for social events and so on. There are people from Lifta living just a few miles from Lifta and what is now East Jerusalem or the West Bank. And in the past few years, they have engaged in an effort to try to return to Lifta and reclaim it and to say, these are our homes, this is our land, And we have a right to be there. And so that has involved things like going back to Lifta, taking groups, taking younger people, and going back and, for example, cleaning the cemetery and tending the graveyard, because that's where the ancestors are buried and their graves have been neglected. And to assert that the people of Lifta have a right to go back, that they have a right to go back because they lived there, because it was their place of residence for generations, and also because there's personal property there, homes, land, and so on. On the other hand, what they're struggling against now is an Israeli plan to turn Lifta into a sort of a luxury resort or condominium complex, building the, you know, taking the old houses and building them into sort of a luxury complex. And this would be for wealthy people, and it would be primarily for Jewish people. And the original owners of Lifta would not have it. Now, for the time being, an Israeli court has stayed this plan on technical grounds, but it's only a temporary reprieve. But the ultimate outcome can be either that the people of Lifta, that their rights are recognized, that they go home, that their property is restituted, or it can be that the process of colonization continues, and the process that has been going on for decades of land being what Israel calls Judaized continues, and that Lifta, just like so many other places, becomes a place for people who have more money, people who are of a particular ethno-religious group, and so on. And this symbolizes, I think, it encapsulates what this is really about. What right do the original inhabitants of the land have? What claims do those who are holding the land make? And what legitimacy do those claims have? Now, this process, we tend to talk about the situation in Palestine as something, you know, that something happened in the past. And in some senses, that's true. A major year, a major date that you will hear talked about often is 1948. Israelis talk about this as the date of independence, of something to celebrate. Palestinians talk about it as the Nakba. Nakba is an Arabic word which means catastrophe. But it marks the year in which the vast majority of Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their land, something like three-quarters of the population at that time. And my mother was one of them. That's when her village of Lifta was forcibly depopulated and they became refugees. But it's important to understand the Nakba not as a historic event to be commemorated or a past wrong to be righted in the future, but it is very much an ongoing process. And it is a violent process. And so one thing that's gotten much less coverage in the news recently is something called the Prawer Plan, Prawer, named after an Israeli official called, that's his name, Prawer. And basically, right now, 40,000 Palestinian Bedouins, these are traditionally nomadic people who live in the south of what is now Israel, it's the south of present-day Israel, are being faced with imminent expulsion from their traditional lands so that Israel can continue to claim this land for Jewish people. Now, an important point here is that these Bedouins who face this, and this is actually going on now, in August, Human Rights Watch issued a call on Israel to stop this process of demolishing the homes and settlements of Palestinian Bedouins and to stop the forcible removal from the land. But it's already going on. Much more is to come, sadly. What's important is that these Palestinian Bedouins are citizens of Israel because they live in the area that is now Israel. But that citizenship does not afford them any protection. And the reason for that is because Israel is the only state in the world, the only state in the world where citizenship is not defined in terms of nationality. So, I mean, to give you an analogy, on paper, in the United States, all citizens are equal. Now, we can argue about how true that is in practice, and that's a very important argument to have. But we understand that on paper, every citizen is supposed to be equal, regardless of their religion, regardless of whether they came here as an immigrant or whether they were born here, regardless of whether they're black, white, Asian, or anything else. Citizenship is citizenship. And that, of course, was not always true in this country. I know that in grade school we're taught that the United States has been a democracy for 200-plus years, but, of course, by any objective standard, it's been a democracy at least, or let's say no further back than the 1960s. But we understand that today citizenship is supposed to be equal. In Israel, that's not the case. Citizenship depends on the government assigning you to one of a number of ethno-religious categories. So in the population registry in Israel, everyone is assigned a category, Jewish, Arab, Druze, Christian, etc. They have a certain list. And your rights depend on which category you're assigned to. And if you're Jewish, you have the most rights. If you're not Jewish, you have lesser rights. And there are something like 35 laws in Israel that distinguish, that privilege Jews over the other groups. And they're laws that have everything to do with access to land, to housing, to property, to immigration, and so, to marriage, and so on and so forth. Now, just in the past 2 weeks, this happened more than 2 weeks ago, but the Supreme Court ruling came just 2 weeks ago. A group of 21 Israeli citizens, including Jews and Palestinian citizens of Israel, went to the Supreme Court to challenge this and to demand that their nationality be changed in the population registry to Israeli. Now, this sounds strange. You see, the Israeli citizens, well, of course their nationality is Israeli, right? But that's not the case. Their nationality is Jewish or Arab or Druze. So they petitioned the court to have their nationality changed to Israeli and not to be assigned to an ethno-religious category. The Supreme Court rejected this petition. And this is, by the way, not the first ruling. There have been, since the 1970s, attempts to overturn this. And the Supreme Court ruled that, no, you cannot, that there is no such thing as an Israeli nationality. There is no Israeli nationality separate from the Jewish nationality, in Israel's terms. And that if we were to grant this petition and allow people to be registered as Israeli, then that would damage Israel's ability to remain what they call a Jewish and democratic state. So I'm going to say something about that because it's a crucial point, but I'm going to come back to it in a few minutes. So the situation of the Bedouins who I talked about is similar to Palestinians in the West Bank and similar to Palestinians all over the country who face this constant process, this continuing Nakba of removal from their land. And so, in a sense, the struggle I referred to over Lifta is one that can be seen throughout the country. Now, for the past more than 20 years, the conception that people have had of what peace looks like, or a peace process, has been very simple. Or it starts with a conception that says, well, you have two groups of people, and they can't live together, so each should have their own little country, and they should be separated. And that's an idea that that for many people is very attractive. It has the advantage of simplicity. It seems logical. It absolves us of the need to worry about, well, why can't they get along? I mean, we just accept they can't get along, and so, you know, give everyone their own little space, and then they won't have to fight with each other. But it's a formula that hasn't worked. And it hasn't worked because it doesn't address the fundamental process that I've been talking about, which is that it's not a conflict between two equal sides. It's not a static situation where you have two groups of people and they're just sitting there staring angrily at each other like the guys in the paintings in the hallway, staring at each other across the hallway. But it is an ongoing violent process of colonization. And it's a process of colonization that has also met with constant Palestinian resistance. And the resistance is what always gets talked about as terrorism. That any resistance from the indigenous people is automatically defined as terrorism. Whether or not it's something that we would ourselves consider to be terrorism. And of course, the term terrorism is one that's very politicized. It's not one that describes a term. If I say to you, if this is a cup of cider, hot cider, and it's quite good, if I say this is cider, you know what I mean by cider. I mean, there are different varieties of cider, but we understand that it's basically, you know, a liquid that comes from pressed apples. Could be hot, it could be cold, it could be alcoholic, it could be non-alcoholic, but we have a common understanding of what cider is. With terrorism, terrorism isn't like that. Terrorism, you know, you could have exactly the same act. But if it's carried out by one type of person, we call it terrorism. If it's carried out by another kind of person, we call it self-defense. We call it a police action. You know, we have all kinds of other polite words for it. So it's important to understand the political nature of describing Palestinian resistance in any form as terrorism. But the process of resistance, which has primarily been nonviolent, incidentally, it has also been constant, just like the colonization has been constant. And sadly, because Israel has so much more power in its hands than the Palestinians, even though Palestinians have resisted this process, the same way Native Americans resisted, but that resistance did not ultimately halt the process of colonization. There are very few examples of Native Americans actually driving settlers out of their lands in North America. It happened for a few decades. The indigenous people in what is now New Mexico succeeded in driving Spanish settlers out, and the Spanish settlers weren't able to return for several decades. But that's an isolated example. There aren't that many examples of that. And ultimately, of course, the settlers came back. And for Palestinians, too, resistance in any form, violence, nonviolence, armed struggle, political struggle, whatever you want, has not succeeded in halting the process of colonization. And so when you talk about this notion of dividing land and saying we're going to have two states, I always like to use a very simple analogy, which is that we're not talking about something that is static. So if instead of thinking about a complicated situation like Palestine-Israel, you think about two people discussing how to slice a pizza and negotiating over how to slice a pizza. Well, that negotiation could have a number of parameters. It could be based on who paid more for the pizza, who worked harder that day, who's hungrier, who likes pepperoni, who doesn't. I mean, you could agree a whole list of criteria for how to negotiate over the pizza. But a problem arises if one of the two parties is eating the pizza as fast as he can while the discussions are going on. And, I mean, it is kind of funny, but the tragedy is this has been the reality of the so-called peace process, is that Palestinians who are relatively powerless have been asked to come and negotiate with Israel over how to divide their land while Israel is busy colonizing the land as fast as it can. And so we have this really farcical situation now where supposedly peace talks are happening while Israel every other day is announcing new Jewish-only settlements on Palestinian land. And obviously that will go nowhere. It simply functions as a cover for continued theft of Palestinian land. So how can we unravel this? A fundamental problem I've identified is the ongoing process of colonization. That's a process that depends on the existence of a vast disparity in power between Israelis on the one hand and Palestinians on the other. But this disparity, of course, exists in a bigger context, a regional context and a global context. And just to keep it very simple, a major part of that context is the fact that the most powerful side, Israel, has the support of the world's biggest power, the United States. So it's an even more lopsided balance. So those are the conditions that allow the colonization process to continue. The point I want to come back to now, which is Israel makes a central claim, and it's hard to go into it in the detail it deserves while sticking to the time limit I've given myself, but I will simply try to introduce it as briefly as I can. We can come back in the discussion. Israel claims that it has a right to exist as a Jewish state, and that any ultimate outcome must guarantee Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. Well, this is a position that has been effectively endorsed by the United States. What does this mean in practice? Well, first of all, we have to ask, how did Israel become a Jewish state? I've already alluded to that, and I won't go into great detail, but it was a process of violent gerrymandering. And I should say, what do we mean by a Jewish state? In practice, I mean, there are many definitions, but the most important one is a state in which, one, Jews are a numerical majority, and two, because of that numerical majority, they can legitimize giving superior rights to those who are designated by the government or by the state as Jews. So it's democratic, you know, it's sort of the antithesis of what we're taught in civics. It's like, we say the tyranny of the majority. That's what they're saying here, is that because we're a majority, we have the right to vote ourselves whatever special privileges we would like to have. And so this majority came about through violent gerrymandering, through the expulsion and flight of the Palestinian people in 1948, and then not allowing them to return. So that's the important point. How it's maintained, this is now crucial. So the simple analogy I'd like to give is if we say that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state, I mean, what is a right? Does anyone want to volunteer a definition of a right? Does Bowdoin have a law school? No, right? It's a liberal arts college. There's no law school here. But basically, there's a foundational legal maxim that there is no right without a remedy. In other words, if you claim you have a right to something, then if someone violates that right, you must be able to have redress for that right. So if somebody steals my cup of cider, I should have legitimate redress for that. I should be able to go to court, have them return the cider. If they've drunk it, to replace the cider, they may be punished. There may be some injunction to prevent them from stealing my cider in the future. Now, it has to be a proper remedy. What does that mean? It means that it's not a proper remedy for me to go and, you know, I might feel satisfied doing it, but I can't just go and take a jug of hot cider and pour it on their head. That wouldn't be a proper remedy. So when you talk about right, there has to be a remedy, and it has to be a proper remedy. So the question then in terms of Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state is, what can threaten this right? The Israelis are very clear about this. They say that if there are too many Palestinians, then we'll lose the majority. Israel will stop being a Jewish state, would have to become, horror of all horrors, a democracy. And so the question then you have to ask is what legitimate means does Israel have to enforce this so-called right? Now, one which they claim is the right to prevent Palestinian refugees from returning home. So they claim that our right to have a Jewish majority trumps the rights of refugees that are recognized everywhere else in the world to go back to the places that they were forced to leave. So you have to decide, is that legitimate? That's number one. But it doesn't stop there. I have mentioned that this might be strange, but some Palestinians are citizens of Israel. The reason for that is not all Palestinians were expelled in 1948. About 10% remained behind, and they were eventually given citizenship, though not full rights, again, because, as I explained, they're not Jewish, but citizens. And today, there are about 1.4 million Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, and other Palestinians are not citizens of Israel. I'll come to that in a minute. But Israel has imposed a number of discriminatory laws against its Palestinian citizens, again, in the name of defending this right to exist as a Jewish state. So one law which they passed in originally in 2003, is called the... These were amendments to what it calls the Nationality and Entry into Israel Law. And it still exists now. And basically, if we come back to the United States, in this country, if you, as a man or a woman, were to fall in love with a man or a woman from another country, you have the right, under U.S. laws, for your spouse to come and live with you. With the recent changes and the striking down of DOMA, that may now extend, as some other countries have, to same-sex partnerships, but I don't think it has yet. But it's long been established that you have the right to bring your spouse to live in the United States. There are certain procedures and residency requirements. You know, you have to live here for 3 years before you get citizenship and so on. But basically, these laws apply to everyone equally. It doesn't matter where your spouse is from. They could be from, you know, Haiti or Ireland or Iran, and the law applies the same way. Under the Israeli law, they said that you can bring your spouse to Israel except if they're Palestinian. Except if they're Palestinian. And who does this target? It targets Palestinian citizens of Israel who tend to marry Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza or from Jordan or from Lebanon who are not citizens of Israel. And Israeli leaders were very explicit at the time in saying, well, you may not like it, but we have a right to be a Jewish state. And if we have all these Palestinians marrying other Palestinians and coming here and having children, then that threatens our right to exist as a Jewish state. So I could give you many more examples, but I won't. But the point of that example is I hope it puts into stark relief what the implications are of what you claim, of when you claim that a state has a right to a certain demographic makeup. This would be like Maine defining itself, or the United States defining itself as a Christian and democratic state. Now, you may say that the history of the country has effectively been that way, but the way we've been moving, or the way we've been struggling to move, is away from that and towards inclusion. When I talk about this notion of having a nationality that is not an American nationality, that would be like each one of us having in our American passports, if we have an American passport or whatever passport we may have, that our nationality is not American or British or Lebanese would be a good example where they have this sectarian system, but where instead our nationality is white or Christian or Jewish or whatever else. And I think we understand that's not something that is acceptable. Israel claims that it's exceptional and it ought to be able to discriminate in this way. I would argue otherwise. Now, so I have talked about the continuing process of colonization. I've talked about Israel's claim that it has a right to be a Jewish state, which I would argue in practice means a right to be racist against Palestinians and others, but primarily against Palestinians. And so then the question is, what's the answer to this? And how do we get there? I would argue that the answer is not a division of the pizza. I would argue that the answer is ending the process of colonization and beginning a process of decolonization. And what does that mean in practice? It certainly means ending the violent Judaization of land. It means beginning a process where Palestinians who have been excluded are allowed to return. It means a process of building a new basis for everybody in the country, Palestinians, Israeli Jews, and others, to live as equals. And it means a political framework that can protect to the maximum extent possible the rights of everyone. And that includes, of course, the right to practice their religion, to nurture their own culture, and to live the way they see fit without impinging on the rights of others. Tomorrow in Middlebury, I'm going to be giving a talk that focuses on more on that. It focuses on the question of, is this possible? And how could you get there? And that's something we can talk about more in the Q&A. I won't have time to go into that level of detail here. But what I will argue tomorrow in Middlebury, and in fact I'll argue in a book that I've just finished that should be coming out in the spring, is that this is possible. And we've seen it happen, or we've seen the process begin to happen in places including South Africa and Northern Ireland. And I go into that in greater depth. And what it involves is a couple of things, a couple of basic principles that we can point out, is that the dominant group, whether that is whites in apartheid South Africa, Protestant unionists in Northern Ireland, or Israeli Jews in historic Palestine, will have to give up their claim to privileged and special status, will have to give up their control of the state, will have to give up the mentality and privileges of settler colonialism. In exchange for that, they would be indigenized as citizens in a state, in a civil state. What we also learn from South Africa and to an extent from Northern Ireland and other places, but those are the two examples I focus on, is that this is incredibly difficult and that there are real pitfalls. One of the common and correct criticisms of the post-1994 settlement in South Africa. So 1994, of course, was the year the formal white minority regime ended and was replaced with a one-person, one-vote system, and Nelson Mandela was elected president. But one of the criticisms, or a key criticism, is that the black majority gained political rights and political equality, but the white minority maintained its hold on the economy, and so black people haven't really obtained true equality, and that decolonization has not really taken place. And that's very true. And I think that's a criticism that we don't need to travel as far as South Africa in order to make. I think the United States is a perfectly good example of that, where we're all very proud of the achievements of the civil rights era, although some of them, there have been concerted efforts to undo them, including the recent decision by the Supreme Court to nullify parts of the Voting Rights Act. But in general, there's a consensus. You know, nobody in public life in the United States would ever think about, calling for the restoration of Jim Crow. It's unthinkable. That system has been completely delegitimized. But the question remains about whether liberal rights, saying everyone is equal, everyone can vote, has actually resulted in practical equality when you look at the really deep and lasting disparities in this country that are still so clear along racial lines. And it's down to the point of, on average, you will live longer if you're white. You live a longer life, a healthier life, and a richer life, on average. That's still true. And that's systemic. And so the question then is, what can we learn from those experiences so that you build into a political process or a political settlement the kinds of processes of restitution and real deep decolonization that, number one, ethically bring people to a similar level, and at the same time create a common basis of citizenship so that people can begin to identify with each other. But I'm optimistic it can happen. I could have spent the time telling you a lot more about the catastrophic situation that Palestinians face, particularly in Gaza, where I traveled in May, and I can say more about that in the Q&A if you're interested. And I could come up with 1,000 reasons why this should be impossible. But my own experience and talking to Palestinians everywhere is that I think there is a continued thirst for justice, not a thirst for revenge. And that has to be the basis of a future settlement. In the final couple of minutes, I want to address what our role can be in this country and what our role on campuses can be and in civil society. And I think we can play a very big role. When we were discussing at lunch today, I was remembering that when I was in a university in the late 1980s, early 90s, the solidarity struggle against apartheid in South Africa was very strong on American campuses. And in many campuses, including mine, students would build mock townships, mock shanties on campus in the quads to educate other students about what was happening in South Africa. And a key component of the campaign was the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And the logic of this is very straightforward, that if you have a regime doing odious things, you shouldn't be complicit. You shouldn't support it. And if you can do things that weaken it, you ought to do them. So the call was on universities to withdraw their, universities have big endowments and pension funds, and they have lots and lots of money, and they invest it. And so the call was on universities to pull out of companies that were doing business in South Africa or profiting from the apartheid system. And today there's a similar call from Palestinians to people around the world, help us. Support our struggle. Understand that Israel is here in terms of power and we're here. And that you can't really have dialogue, you can't have negotiations when you have such a huge imbalance of power. And so there are different ways to bring about a balance. One might be armed struggle. But if you want to avoid bloodshed, if you want to ease the path of the future, then you have to have some kind of struggle that's ethical, but at the same time can begin to challenge that balance of power. And so in 2005, 170 Palestinian organizations got together and they issued a call on people around the world to impose boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns on Israel, similar to those that had been used against South Africa, until three basic demands are met. One, that Israel ends its military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Two, that Israel ends the kinds of discrimination I mentioned and others against Palestinian citizens of Israel. And three, that Israel respects the right of Palestinian refugees to come home even if they're not Jews. And so those three basic demands are rooted in universal principles of human rights and international law. And the campaign has really been gaining a lot of steam. And it's really generated a huge backlash, with large national organizations spending a lot of money to try to malign this movement, to try to claim it's anti-Semitic, to try to claim that boycott, divestment and sanctions is, anti-peace or anti-dialogue, that it hurts people's feelings, a whole lot of propaganda like that. Of course, it's very important for all of us to emphasize clearly and repeatedly that the Palestinian struggle is not a struggle against Jews or Jewish people, and the Jewish people are not the oppressors of Palestinians. The oppressors of Palestinians is the Israeli state and those who support it and who are complicit in it. And in the struggle against this oppression and the struggle to create an alternative that is inclusive of everyone, there are also people of all backgrounds. There are many Jewish people. There are LGBT people, particularly in the struggles on campuses in the U.S. This is an important point because Israel has been trying to fight back by a strategy that some have called pinkwashing, which is to paint Israel as this haven for LGBT rights amid this sort of Middle Eastern ocean of intolerance, and therefore to say to LGBTQ people, you should overlook what Israel is doing to Palestinians because, you know, Israel is such a wonderful place to come for a vacation and go to nightclubs in Tel Aviv. That's a very divisive kind of politics where you try to play one group off against another. But I think that I don't think it's succeeding. So I'll end by saying that what I hope that you'll do, especially those of you who aren't very familiar with this topic, is when you hear arguments about it or when you read something about it, to keep these things in mind, to ask yourself a number of questions. Who has the power in this situation? Who has the strength? Who can impose on others a reality? If you're in the position of those who are the weakest, what options would you have? What would you do in their situation? And finally, ask yourself, is there anything you can do? If you care about all the people in this situation, Palestinians and Israelis, what can you do to help them get out of it? You're very fortunate to have on campus a really wonderful group of students for Justice in Palestine, who I've really enjoyed spending time with. But they're an amazing resource. And I hope that for those of you who are curious, that you will get in touch with them, go out to dinner with them, attend future events, and begin to ask some of the questions that, you know, we will never have time to fully explore in a meeting of an hour and a half or so. So let me stop there, and then I would love to open it up to everyone.
You have been listening to Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima speaking at Bowdoin University.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, The Post-Truth World, reviving the propaganda model of news for our digital age. We'll be joined for the hour by Dr. Rob Williams, longtime contributor to Project Censored. He has a new article addressing an update for the propaganda model for the 21st century. Please stay with us. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit. We're honoring an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world. Without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, The Post-Truth World, reviving the propaganda model of news for our digital age. This is a new article by Dr. Rob Williams. And Rob Williams should be a name that Project Censored listeners know. Rob has been a longtime contributor to the project and also works with us at the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. Rob Williams teaches media communications and global studies at the University of Vermont and is the founding president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. He publishes Vermont Independent News Journal, and you can find his work online at projectcensored.org as well as several other websites. Rob Williams, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Great to be with you, Mickey.
Rob, this is fantastic to have you back. You know, just this past week or so, we replayed one of the Project Censored programs from last fall where you were toying around with the update of the propaganda model. And we had you on, and Abby Martin and Andy Lee Roth, our associate director, and we were talking about, you know, the changing face of media and censorship and media control in an era of post-truth and alternative facts and fake news, right? And you and I got into that conversation, and you said, hey, I'm going to expand on all these ideas. And we were lucky enough to twist your arm, so to speak, into producing this new article that you were already working on.
You were very persuasive, Mickey, and I was ripe for the opportunity. So I'm really excited about this new article that ProjectCensored.org is going to feature, and we'll do our best to get these new filters for the propaganda model of news out there for teachers and students and citizens and independent journalists to work with.
You said it, and it's a mouthful. That's the reason why we talked about putting this online, where we have far more viewers, listeners, people coming and reading. Certainly we have the annual book. But this kind of stuff is really hot, timely, and even though Andy Roth and I are working on the next censored book, that won't be out until the fall. And you know,
this can't wait, Mickey. It can't wait.
It cannot wait, because we started this conversation last fall, and here we are in February. So I think it's time to hit the ground running. The Post-Truth World is the title of your article. Let's remind listeners a little bit that this is riffing on the propaganda model, and Edward Herman, along with Noam Chomsky back in 1988, published a book called Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media. And in this book, riffing on the terminology from Edward Bernays, sort of the grandfather of public relations and propaganda in the U.S.,
right.
nephew of Sigmund Freud, manufacturing consent back in the teens, 20s, 30s, that was basically the way that modern democracies, it was argued by Bernays and other elites, that that's how it ought to be run, that you can kind of control what people are thinking about and talking about by controlling the flow of information. And they believed that this was right, just, and proper. Of course, Ed Herman, the political economist from the University of Pennsylvania, Noam Chomsky, MIT, they put together this book and put together the propaganda model to talk about what's wrong with manufacturing consent from a democratic standpoint or perspective. And as you know, Chapter 7 of Censored 2018, which is Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, that's Ed Herman's last published piece, to my knowledge. He was in his early 90s, and again, the late, great Ed Herman passed away late last year, we're very sad to say. But he gave us one fantastic chapter in an update, and I thought it was amazing how much he was foreshadowing so many of the things that you ended up writing about. So Chomsky and Herman updated their study in 2002, 2008, and then again here, Herman, the Project Censored version, the propaganda model at 30 in our last book, and then you go and take it even a step above that. So we're fortunate to have you for the hour today, Rob, and we have a lot to talk about. So why don't you launch into this and tell us a little bit, just remind listeners, what exactly was the original propaganda model? And then let's kind of bring it up to the present and talk about some ways in which we see propaganda both here going on in the present, and that'll give us an opportunity to apply the new filters that you managed to discuss.
Yeah, that sounds great. I like it. And that was a great setting, Mick. The first thing to say is that everything we're going to talk about in the next little bit is available as a two-page handout for free at vermontindependent.org, and I think Project Censored will carry this as well. It's the propaganda model of news for the digital age, boiled down to two really powerful pages of teaching and learning content. So we hope that everyone listening will check that out at projectcensored.org, vermontindependent.org. And to answer your question, the propaganda model of news was Chomsky and Herman's guided market system analysis, they called it, of six different filters through which they argued all raw information had to pass through in the U.S. so-called news and information culture before it could see the light of day. And they focused on the New York Times, which a lot of people to this day are convinced is the objective daily newspaper of record in the United States, But, of course, their analysis of the New York Times in the mid-1980s, particularly with regard to foreign coverage of U.S. activities abroad, leaves us thinking that perhaps the New York Times is a little bit more subjective and a little bit more complicated than that. So what they did in the propaganda model of news, Chomsky and Herman, is they laid out six different filters through which raw information had to pass to be published as official news in the New York Times and other outlets. And those six filters were, in order, number one, ownership, number two, advertising, number three, news makers. We're going to add a fourth filter, news shapers, number five, what they called negative criticism or flack, and number six, ideology, which in the 1980s, the ideology of which they spoke, of course, was anti-communism, using the Cold War as a frame to determine which stories were newsworthy in the New York Times and which were not, and using that ideology filter as well as a framing device for determining how to tell particular stories, the particular so-called news stories that they did. So those were the six filters that Chomsky and Herman argued you could understand why the U.S. news system produced the so-called news and information that it did, if you understood how those six filters worked to allow certain kinds of news stories told in certain kinds of ways through the filters into published news, and how they blocked or censored or suppressed or ignored or downplayed other vital news stories told in different sorts of frames from seeing the light of day and public conversation. So that's, in a nutshell, how the propaganda model of news worked in their conceptual model. Six filters together creating a guided market system for the production of news and information by the New York Times and, by extension, the U.S. news industry. And it is an industry, the news industry as a whole.
Yeah, it's private and for-profit. And just so listeners maybe don't get confused, the original propaganda model, as you said, had five filters, but you broke up the third, sourcing in a way that really is sort of like news makers and shapers, is so maybe a more specific kind of terminology.
Yes, and we actually borrowed that idea from the Media Education Foundation, another big partner and collaborator with Project Censored and ACME and Vermont Independent. They did a video version of the propaganda model of news with Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman in the early 1990s, and they actually nuanced out the third filter, newsmakers, into two. One was newsmakers, individuals by their kind of high-profile status who were deemed worthy of news, the President of the United States, the First Lady, the Supreme Court, etc. And then what they called news shapers, as you mentioned, which were organizations like think tanks, foundations, PR firms that were in the business literally of shaping, massaging, shaping the news through all kinds of often hidden production means.
Indeed. And you're referring to Media Education Foundation, mediaed.org. That's Sut Jolly and the team he has. They make fantastic documentaries about media, including the one you have. And of course, we'll be sure to link all of the things that we're referring to on our social media. So when this goes up in social media, which, by the way, we'll be talking about later as another part of the landscape for the propaganda model, right?
Yes, we will.
We'll definitely link to these, though, so that listeners can go and click on it, certainly see the older film that Sut did and so forth. But so now that we have this idea, and it's important also to point out that Edward Herman was very clear, and he also reiterated this in the last article he did in Censor 2018 for the propaganda model at 30. Herman, it was interesting because he tackled some of the critics in the chapter. And what he pointed out was, he said a lot of the people that were criticizing the model were criticizing straw person. They were criticizing things that Chomsky and Herman never said or purported. And they were ignoring the mountains of evidence that they laid out in their 1988 book. And so this is, of course, what led to a couple of different updates and so on. And Herman reiterates this in his last piece by saying, "We never said that this explained everything. But as a model for a theoretical construct for understanding propaganda, censorship, and what shapes news in a for-profit system," he argued that it has stood the test of time. And I agree with him, and I believe you do as well, and I know that that's part of your conclusion in your article that listeners can see at projectcensored.org. But let's bring us up to the present here momentarily, because there's definitely a lot of things going on right now. In fact, it's breakneck speed. There's studies and articles going on about fake news and you know, bots and filters and all kind of things that we're going to get into here in a bit. But there's also something else in the news, and that's a movie movie about the news. That's The Post. And you have a wonderful pithy, that's with a T-H, F-C-C, pithy and witty title, The Post Truth World. And you start out with a film review of what's going on in Steven Spielberg's film, The Post. And Kevin Gostola, the independent journalist, was on the show not long ago talking about The Post. Tell us a little bit about your reaction to that film as a way of launching into the update of the model itself.
So Steven Spielberg delivered a really brilliant, feel-good, fictional film about the Washington Post's 1971 publishing of Daniel Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers. And, you know, true to Spielberg's style, it's a beautifully shot movie. It is a feel-good film, and it's also a piece of propaganda. And it was really sort of striking to watch Meryl Streep, who plays the Post's proto-feminist publisher, Katharine Graham, playing opposite Tom Hanks, who is the likably macho Post editor Ben Bradley, and how the two of them work with their news team against all odds, of course, which is the Hollywood trope, to deliver this very important story about the U.S. government's lies and deceptions around the U.S. invasion of Vietnam to the public and throwing that whole conversation into the public arena. It's a piece of propaganda because, of course, a lot of what appears in Hollywood movies based on so-called, you know, real-life events are fictionalized and made up and imagined and cribbed, etc. But the other really interesting thing about the film is that it completely ignores the role that the commercial news media in the United States played in pumping up support for the U.S. invasion of Vietnam and the Vietnam War as a whole for years and years and years before Katharine Graham and Ben Bradley saw the light and decided to deliver Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers to the world. Namely and specifically, and I know listeners of Project Censored will appreciate this, the relationship that the Central Intelligence Agency, the so-called deep state player here, cultivated with U.S. news editors, publishers, behind the scenes and in secret to promote the pro-U.S. invasion position in Vietnam without making any of that clear to U.S. citizens, to readers. And this went on for years and years and years. Behind the scenes, the CIA conspiring with U.S. news bigwigs to promote the U.S. invasion.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Brian Covert has a fantastic piece at Censored 2017 on the Mighty Wurlitzer, right, played by the Mighty Wurlitzer. And in fact, he cites, just because we're talking about The Post, and I'm going to get back to your critique of The Post here momentarily, but Katharine Graham, let's recall, the same year that Chomsky and Herman published Manufacturing Consent, Katharine Graham had a transcript of a speech that she delivered at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, called Secrecy and the Press. This is the same Graham that is, I believe, portrayed quite heroically in Spielberg's estimation. And Graham here, actually, she's chief executive officer of the Washington Post at the time. She said, quote, "It's an inescapable irony of democratic government that official secrecy is necessary to preserve liberty. We live in a dirty and dangerous world. There are some things the general public does not need to know and shouldn't. The government must have a classification system and should discipline employees who violate security regulations." Fascinating that Daniel Ellsberg doesn't play a major role in Spielberg narrative.
Yeah, he's played by Matthew Rhys-Meyer, and it's really Bob Odenkirk, actually, who really kind of steals the show as Post reporter Ben Bagdikian, who goes on, of course, to write one of the most important media critiques of our time, which is The Media Monopoly. But, you know, back to Katharine Graham's point, and I love that you bring this in here, Mickey, because, you know, Graham's wording is really curious. It's like, this isn't about the suppression of information. I mean, it is about that, but it's also about the active promotion of disinformation by U.S. news journals at the behest of the deep state.
Rob Williams, hold on to that thought for 1 minute. Misinformation and disinformation. I just need to remind our listeners that I'm your host, Mickey Huff. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. Our guest today for the hour is media scholar and historian as well as activist, Dr. Rob Williams. And we'll be back to continue our conversation about an update of the propaganda model for the 21st century. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On the program today, we're joined by Dr. Rob Williams. He teaches media communications and global studies at the University of Vermont. He's also the founding president of the Action Coalition for Media Education, publishes Vermont Independent News Journal. Rob Williams is a longtime contributor and partner with Project Censored and ACME, as well as co-founder of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. You can learn more about that at gcml.org. And Rob, I believe ACME is smartmediaeducation.net, yes?
That's correct. ACME, smartmediaeducation.net.
Right. Certainly, definitely an organization that people should be aware of and check out. But Rob, let's continue our conversation here on the propaganda model. And we were reviewing, you were reviewing and sharing your thoughts with us about the Post. And I was chiming in and interrupting and making asides and detours as we professorial types are wont to do. But before the break, you brought up this very important piece about Katharine Graham, and you were talking about disinformation. And I just wanted to simply have a very quick differentiation for the listeners to make sure that it's very clear. Misinformation is mistaken information that's transmitted to the public. Disinformation is deliberate information that is fed that is erroneous or deceptive, correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, so I just wanted to make that point. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think of misinformation usually as kind of a one-off, too. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, we made a mistake. We misinformed you. Here's what actually happened. But disinformation typically is part of a larger strategy of propaganda and deceit. I love that quotation that you give us from Katharine Graham, because clearly here she is in front of the CIA justifying the use of systematic disinformation campaigns by the U.S. press at the behest of the CIA and the deep state, because ordinary citizens are too dumb to grapple with the complex, dirty realities of the day, which is sort of insulting at best.
Well, kind of channeling some H.L. Mencken there from the period of Lippmann and Bernays back in the 20s. And we certainly heard Chomsky and Herman. They make this kind of quipper saying, like, well, these folks think the people or the public are too stupid and ignorant, and they need to try to help them think. And that's where these disinformation campaigns come into play. And certainly the Post. I mean, the ironies are writ large, I suppose, if you look between the Times and the Post, that herald themselves and herald their own greatness about breaking Watergate and these kind of things, which they didn't do, by the way. And that's actually the genesis of Project Censored, right? Is Carl Jensen going back and seeing that there were other media covering this prior to Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. But at least to Bernstein's credit, he wrote a great piece in Rolling Stone on CIA media in 1977, looking at the history of purposeful disinformation. And then there's Graham 11 years later at Langley, basically saying this is what we need to do. So anyway, I digress. But let's get on to your conclusion about what you think is going on with the film The Post. And then let's kind of talk a little bit more about, well, what exactly is news and what is fake news? And let's start unpacking some of that stuff. But what are your concluding thoughts about The Post?
Well, you know, I sort of ended by kind of bringing up the history of the Post to the present. So the Graham family, after working with the deep state and the CIA for decades to engage in disinformation campaigns while celebrating their breaking stories in the form of the Pentagon Papers and, of course, the Watergate scandal, where, by the way, Steven Spielberg ends the Post. He ends the Post with the Watergate break-in, and it was all Nixon's fault, you know. But the Graham family sold the Washington Post in 2013, 5 years ago, for $250 million to Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, who is now the world's richest man worth $100 billion. And so we now have a newspaper out of Washington, D.C., owned by a gentleman who sits on Pentagon boards, a gentleman who enjoys a $600 million cloud computing contract with the Central Intelligence Agency, and who runs a monopoly retail corporation that is hoovering, you know, one out of every two U.S. retail dollars out of our national retail economy.
And more recently, Whole Foods.
Yep. And having bought Whole Foods. And rumor has it, and I've been trying to sort of confirm this publicly, but the Washington Post, under Bezos's orders, apparently now has guidelines, and I use the word guidelines loosely, in place that dictate that no Washington Post reporter can write or publish anything that is critical of, wait for it, Amazon, or any of its advertising partners, which is to say just about everybody.
You remember that the Post was, when there were some people talking about the extraordinary wealth of Bezos and others, the Washington Post bent over backwards and did these crazy, you know, mental gymnastics to talk about how he's not really that rich and so on. I mean, it was absolutely absurd degree of propaganda. But anyway, go ahead.
It's really astonishing. Yeah. So that's where we are today. We have the country's probably most powerful DC-based daily newspaper in the hands of the richest man in the world, who is probably the most predatory corporate capitalist we've seen in quite some time. And again, with connections to the Pentagon and the CIA. So a better illustration of a kind of fatal ending of the Post you probably could not ask for.
So let's pick up from there. We obviously realize that Hollywood has long worked with Washington, D.C. to make these kinds of films. And they certainly are trying to reinforce. In fact, what is the new slogan at the Washington Post?
Democracy dies in darkness.
Indeed. Indeed. And Jeff Bezos is there to turn out the lights.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, again, this is a news business, and this is what Chomsky and Herman were hitting at. And you mentioned Bagdikian earlier. In the very early 1980s, about 6 years before Manufacturing Consent was published, he wrote The Media Monopoly, and he was decrying the consolidation of media ownership, canary in coal mine fashion, that there were only 50 news corporations. And here we're down to 5 or 6. Right?
Correct.
So let's talk about this then. So in the 21st century, what is news? Well, you have a simple taxonomy that you go into. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you were defining this in your article?
I define real news with 6 sort of fairly straightforward elements. And I know you've done so many great stories on fake news. And I think you and I both agree, and probably many of your listeners do too, fake news is a weaponized phrase for an old phenomenon, which is propaganda, you know, the one-sided information distribution. Real news, on the other hand, I think has 6 criteria. Number 1, real news is recent. Number 2, real news is relevant. Number 3, and here's where it gets more interesting, real news is reliable, which is to say it's accurately and transparently sourced. Number 4, real news is framed historically, so it has historical context. Number 5, real news is what I like to say hegemonically hip, which is to say it exposes or makes transparent power relations in the story. And number 6, real news is multi-perspectival, or it's harmonious. It gives you a story from multiple points of view, not just kind of the he said, she said, or the either or dualistic frame that we're so used to, but really looks at different points of view from different players connected and invested in a story of record. So those 6 characteristics in our mind make up so-called real news. And when you define real news that way, you realize that it can be hard to find out there.
Indeed, it is, actually. And I mean, I again want to remind readers, we're speaking with Dr. Rob Williams. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. Rob Williams has a new article on the Project Censored site called The Post-Truth World, Reviving the Propaganda Model of News for Our Digital Age. And Rob, you just talked about so-called real news. But it's also interesting that you do spend a little bit of time in the article talking about a taxonomy of fake news, infotainment, yeah, junk food news that we've talked about at the project for years, news abuse, which is basically a form of propaganda, deep state disinformation, clickbait, right? So you do go in and differentiate this, right? And then you kind of riff on what I'm now referring more to our epistemological crisis, so to speak.
Yes.
Project Censored used to talk about a truth emergency, but this is an epistemological crisis in which we find ourselves with this real versus fake news conundrum in social media.
That's correct. And I'm fond, as I know you are, Mickey, of quoting the great progressive journalist George Seldes, who said very famously, journalism's job is not impartial, quote unquote, balanced reporting. Journalism's job is not impartial, balanced reporting. Journalism's job is to tell the people what is really going on. And I think that's what's missing in our 21st century news culture today. The truth emergency is very real. This epistemological crisis in which you speak is very real. And most importantly, and solutions-oriented, the propaganda model of news is a very powerful antidote to that truth emergency, that state of epistemological crisis, because it offers us, Chomsky and Herman, with some updates, they offer us a really powerful conceptual tool, easy to understand, about how so-called news is produced and how we might best understand what passes for news these days.
Well, indeed. And, you know, as of late, there have been so many people writing more and more about this, I think, in important ways. I know Caitlin Johnson has a recent article. there's actually another study going on that talks about fake news as a right-wing thing, and I would certainly take issue with that. I think that the problem of fake news, as you've helped outline some of those issues in your article, those are long-standing and old in terms of propaganda and disinformation. But let's focus a little bit more of our attention on the antidote to some of this stuff, and you and I are both neck-deep in this, and that's, of course, critical media literacy education is the antidote to so-called fake news and propaganda. And so you spend time in the article, of course, talking about what are some new tools? What are some new ways that we can think about what's happening in our news media landscape? So maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the solutions. I know we're going to end up coming back into some of these other conversations, but you know, perhaps you want to talk a little bit about what some of these updates have been.
Let me lay out the filters that I suggest we add to the propaganda model of news to bring it up into the digital age in the 21st century. And to your point about solutions, critical media literacy education is crucial. And I think the propaganda model of news offers us some very powerful critical media literacy education tools. Each filter of the 11, really, filters in the model now that we're proposing, each of those 11 filters is in itself a critical media literacy education tool for understanding what's going on out there. And I wanted to say one other thing about the propaganda model. It's a very powerful conceptual tool. But the other thing that Edward Herman pointed out in the Project Censored 2018 essay that he wrote right before he died is that even communications scholars who study media and communications as their profession have dramatically underutilized, even ignored, the propaganda model of news in scholarly journals. I think they cite one study in which they look at 10 years of communications journals, and I think the propaganda model is cited 2.5% of the time in these articles, which to me was sort of astonishing.
I mean, it's interesting you brought that up, because in the introduction to the Censored 2012 book, I actually pointed that out, specifically looking at Daniel Halland and Michael Judson. And I specifically pointed out how there was just a paucity of referencing and sourcing of this very crucial, important part of critical media literacy education, communication studies theory. It's just like disappeared down the memory hole, right? And I think it's very important that you point that out. And perhaps, Rob Williams, you might want to give us your thoughts about that. Why is it, do you think, that Chomsky and Herman's tool and now these updates of it, why do you think that this is being eschewed by establishment academics?
I honestly don't know, Mickey, and I'm going to be attending a bunch of conferences this next year, and I plan to ask that question because to me it's a no-brainer. I mean, it's a powerful, easy-to-access conceptual framework that I've been using with my students. They get it. They love it. They say, this makes a lot of sense when you kind of lay it out this way, why we get the so-called news and information that we get. It resonates with them. So to me, that just tells me that we should be using it much more than we seem to have been in the past couple of decades.
Well, Rob Williams, we're going to take another quick break here. But when we come back, we want to get into your updates, your additions to the filters of the propaganda model. I'm Mickey Huff, the host of the Project Censored Show. Today, we are rejoined by our good friend, Dr. Rob Williams. And after this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation on an update to the propaganda model for the 21st century. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, your host. Today we're joined by Dr. Rob Williams. He is a professor and media scholar at the University of Vermont. He is one of the founding presidents of ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education. Rob is a longtime contributor to Project Censored, and you can read about a very recent piece that he has published with us. It is the topic of our conversation today, The Post-Truth World, Reviving the Propaganda Model of News for Our Digital Age. And of course, Rob Williams, this is also kind of a tribute to the late, great Edward Herman, who sadly passed away late in 2017. Certainly, Edward Herman was a giant in the field, along with Noam Chomsky and many others. There's a very interesting quote you and I wanted to go through and now start updating the new filters for the digital age. And right. I just stumbled in, however, to this passage that you quoted from the last piece that Herman published, The Propaganda Model at 30. He said that the propaganda model is as strong and applicable as it was 30 years ago. The structural conditions have, if anything, given it more salience with greater media concentration, but still more competition for advertising revenue, enhanced power and reach of advertisers, and little if any diminution in the effects of the other three filters. What is more, the performance of the mainstream media, the corporate mainstream media, is in treating the run-up to the Iraq war, the conflict with Iran, and Russia's alleged election meddling and aggression in Ukraine and Crimea, offers case studies of biases as dramatic as those offered in the 1988 edition of Manufacturing Consent. And Edward Herman concludes, the propaganda model lives on. And indeed, Rob Williams, you say yes, with three caveats. Five more filters to refine the right. propaganda model of news. And that's where we're going right now. So why don't you launch us into this? Tell us, what are these additions? And again, I know I spoke with Edward Herman on the phone last summer, and this was one of the things that we discussed. We literally discussed the digital age. We had a deadline to meet. And Herman bemoaned, actually, to me. He said, I just wish I had more time. I mean, little did we know how prescient that was and how bigger of a statement that was on his behalf. But he really was thinking about along the same lines as where you're taking this. And I wanted listeners to know that he and I had that conversation.
Oh, that's great.
Which is, again, what so piqued my interest when I saw you were doing this last fall. And I'm just excited that you really followed through with this, Rob Williams. So take us there.
It really is a tribute to Ed Herman, and he is such a legend and a giant, and he has shaped so much of my thinking about media and so much I know of yours and many of our colleagues who we work with quite closely around the world on this. So I did intend this article at projectcensored.org to be a tribute. And I also wanted to, in the tradition of scholarly thinking and research and the work that we do collaboratively, to kind of push us a little bit on it. And I do think that in the last piece he wrote in Project Censored, he was a little too quick to equate the age of analog with the age of digital. And so these filters that we've laid out here in this two-page handout, in this article, are really designed to build on the filtered model that Chomsky and Herman give us and bring us into the digital age. So the first filter of the digital age is what we call deep state disinformation. The term deep state is one that's now cracking into the cultural mainstream. And, you know, books are being written by whistleblowers and people coming out of the deep state about how the deep state works. And quite simply, the deep state refers to unelected organizations that work within federal channels of power to shape events and policy. The CIA, the Pentagon, the FBI, the DEA are four that come to mind. And as we already talked about, we don't need to belabor it, but as we talked about, the Central Intelligence Agency was very actively collaborating with U.S. news publishers, editors, and high-profile national newspapers and magazines for decades to promote U.S. policies at home and abroad.
I just wanted to say very quickly, because the word deep state is being thrown around an awful lot just in the past year. And of course, we know Mike Lofgren, a former staffer in Congress, has written a book and a few others. I just want to do a quick hat tip here to people like Peter Dale Scott, David Palbat. You know, these are people that have done serious, long-term, historical, scholarly work on the deep state. So it does pain me some to see the term thrown around sloppily. And you are not, of course. That's my point. You are using the term in deep historiographic context. And look, we can go right all the way back to C. Wright Mills, Eisenhower, military-industrial complex. This is a real
power
thing.
Power elite, sure, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is not deep state headquarters has an address at Pennsylvania Avenue. This is a theoretical construct in many ways like the propaganda model. So I just wanted to throw that out there because there are some folks in the blogosphere and in the press that like to demean the deep state term as some kind of wacky conspiracy idea, when in fact Peter Dale Scott says that it is not. It's a real thing, and you can point to it even though it's nebulous. But I think it's very important that you're calling out that this is a demonstrable engine that does drive a public narrative.
Yeah. I really think it is. And it's interesting rereading Manufacturing Consent, because Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky understood deep in their bones how the deep state massaged news and information. They didn't use that term, but they used lots of other terms similar to it to describe what's going on. So we're kind of calling it out here, and we urge anybody who's interested in this new propaganda model 2.0 for the digital age to really look closely at the scholarly work done, as you say, around the deep state. The next filter we talk about, and this is a word we hear quite a bit now, is the filter known as the algorithm or algorithms. Algorithms, very simply, are computer code programs that are designed to shape our experience on digital media platforms. And algorithms can be tweaked and edited and changed, often without us knowing, to shape the kinds of news and information we receive or don't receive. And most famously and most recently, we talk about this in the article that at projectcensor.org. Last April, Google announced that in the name of fighting so-called fake news, they were going to tweak their algorithm to divert traffic away from so-called inappropriate or somehow controversial news sites like Truthdig, Truthout, Alternet, typically progressive, independent, or sites that are fairly critical of the status quo. And that was a real kind of wake-up call, I think, for a lot of people within the news and information world to the power of the algorithm to do in secret what used to take a lot longer and a lot more time and energy to do in the face-to-face world. You probably have some thoughts to add there, Mick.
We had some business in the Censored 2018 book about the problem of algorithms and how might that shape news and build confirmation bias, the degree to which people really are kind of only seeking out to confirm that which they already believe or suspect to be true. That's one of the ways in which so-called fake news allegedly was impacting the population. Again, I think that rising to the occasion of the effect of algorithms, to me, goes right back to the basic issues of critical thinking education and critical media literacy. Is the best antidote or protection toward these things is being aware of your confirmation bias and seeking out information that doesn't only confirm it, but factually you can point and say, well, these things are happening. These are empirical facts. Square peg, round hole. Maybe this doesn't fit into my belief system, but that doesn't mean it isn't a fact. The big problem with algorithms, right, is that these things are working against us literally in a way that they're allegedly working for us to continue to please us. Aldous Huxley comes to mind. But we see people at Facebook and others admitting that this is a problem, admitting that this is not necessarily a great idea. But they're also now deliberately using algorithms to turn down or tune out or spike or suppress sources that are critical of the establishment that they are increasingly making synonymous with fake news.
That's right. So think of the algorithm filter as something that is done to us as digital news consumers, often in secret, by the coders who work for these very powerful digital corporations, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, etc. And it's important to be aware of them and kind of track information in real time about how algorithms are changed, often without us knowing, and how that might impact our news choices.
By the way, you call that algorithmic censorship.
Yes.
You used the phrase algorithmic censorship. And by the way, all the companies you just mentioned are part of the octopus. Yeah. That's this other conversation we're not having, the new breaking up of all these oligopolies of media and information.
Yeah, we got to break up the lords of the cloud. So there's algorithmic censorship. There's deep state disinformation. The third filter we identify is one coined by MoveOn.org and Upworthy.org co-founder Eli Pariser. It's a term your listeners probably know, and that is the term filter bubble. The filter bubble is something that we do to ourselves through repeated news search to the same sites, the same sources over time. The filter bubble works to kind of, as you said just a moment ago, corroborate our choices and exclude other options, other points of view, other ways of thinking or feeling about things that don't immediately conform to our own biases. So being aware of one's filter bubble and pushing oneself outside of one's kind of comfort zone with regard to news is a really important critical media literacy education action that all of us can take, regardless of our politics, to really begin to try and see things from different points of view. And that's ultimately the essence of healthy democracy and debate, is being able to engage with people and organizations who think or feel differently than we do.
Well, Rob Williams, you just said another mouthful here. Not only do we have these bubbles in our virtual reality and in our online presence and in the social media world, we actually kind of have them in the physical world, right? Geographically.
Yeah.
Was just talking to our producer here, Dennis, who was just traveling about that, and he was in Texas and was just talking about, you know, just the very immediate kind of stereotypical differences in communications and, oh, you're from California, or, you know, these kinds of things. And basically, this is what you're getting at online with the filter bubble.
That's right. And it's a really insidious one, because confirmation bias, you know, is a very real phenomenon. And we all want to have our ways of thinking and feeling about the world confirmed for us. It makes us feel more secure in an insecure world. And yet, it works against us in terms of really understanding multiple points of view and different perspectives on things. So super important to flag that as a term delivered to us, phenomenon delivered to us by the digital age.
I would add two other terms relatively synonymous with confirmation bias, and that these are, you've seen certainly in sociological circles, but definitely used as ways of understanding electoral behavior and general beliefs of the public that fuel electoral behavior. And those terms, of course, you're familiar with, are motivated reasoning and inferred justification, right? Going back and looking at something, there must be a reason that this happened. And if the establishment narrative was incorrect and mistakes were made with WMDs, there must be a reason we invaded Iraq. That must be because Hussein was behind 9/11, because it was ritually conflated in the Bush administration without actually being stated outright that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein were somehow two nefarious characters that lived together and partied it up to, you know, see the demise of the United States, the great white devil, even though they were in fact enemies and Hussein kept those the Al-Qaeda cells out of Iraq until we invaded. But that's one of the classic examples of inferred justification, motivated reasoning. It's a real problem, because it was 70-odd percent of the public that ended up believing these falsehoods that ended up leading to the support for that catastrophic invasion, leaving 1.5 million people dead and 6 million refugees. That's still going on. So confirmation bias, inferred justification, motivated reasoning, filter bubbles, algorithmic censorship, these lead the public. They manufacture consensus, right? These are the dots we're trying to connect as we go through here, going back to Bernays, through Chomsky, Herman, and now here through you, Rob, in your latest piece, The Post-Truth World, right? And we're reviving the propaganda model of news for our digital age. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. So, Rob Williams, let's go and look and continue down the list. You have, after filter bubbles and after you talk about algorithms, you have another filter.
This one is really super insidious, and I'm still sort of astonished by it. It's called behavioral micro-targeting. And this is a term, behavioral micro-targeting, that has been coined by a UK-based consulting company called Cambridge Analytica. Project Censored readers are familiar probably with Robert Mercer, the reclusive mathematician, algorithmist, and philanthropist who has funded a number of right-wing organizations. But Cambridge Analytica boasts an astonishing 5,000 pieces of individual data on each of 220 million U.S. voters. And they claim that they can reach into the world of digital media networks, Facebook, Twitter, for example, and behaviorally micro-target key niche groups of people in various swing states, for example, to sway a presidential election through changing these micro groups' behavior based on the data they have collected about them. And they have claimed also, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, that the Trump campaign in 2016, in the weeks before the election results, hired Cambridge Analytica to engage in this sort of behavioral micro-targeting to massage key groups of U.S. voters in key demographic areas to help swing the outcome. But the larger phenomenon going on here is this. If Cambridge Analytica does possess all of this big data on us and can crunch it and reach into the internet, social media platforms, digital media platforms, and without us really realizing what's going on, change, shape, our behavior, that clearly is a universal phenomenon that shapes our understanding of news and information that deserves to be its own filter. So that's why we lay this out as an important filter here in the new propaganda model of News 2.0.
Indeed. And Rob Williams, you have a story that you were a faculty evaluator for with your student. Is it Ketchen McElwain?
Great student.
That story number 4 in Censored 2018, voter suppression in the 2016 presidential election, and that's partly where you do talk a little about all of that happening, correct?
Yes. It's a really important story, and it's just beginning to sort of break in the national media. There's been a little bit of coverage in it in the New York Times, the New Yorker, but I think the powers that be are just getting their heads around what this actually means for voting integrity, democratic discourse. We can blame the Russians for hacking the 2016 election all we want, but this, to me, is the real story of the election of 2016, behavioral micro-targeting.
And there were some people decrying, like, oh, so there were some Facebook ads. Look, how many billions of dollars are being spent by the two major parties,
well,
the military-industrial complex, the security complex? How many billions of dollars of profits were the media making when Les Moonves, CEO of CBS, was just crowing about how Donald Trump was bad for America but great for CBS and shareholders?
Great for ratings.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
So I mean, there's a lot more problems right here at home that don't involve Vladimir Putin. We've got enough things to worry about here, and you're certainly giving us a lot to think about, particularly around the issue of behavioral micro-targeting. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. Our guest today is media scholar and historian, as well as activist, Dr. Rob Williams. And we'll be back to continue our conversation. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're joined by Dr. Rob Williams. He teaches media communications and global studies at the University of Vermont. So you've got two other filters here that we want to address.
Yeah, just to finish up. So filter number 10 is what we call sock puppets, which is a fun term for really what are fake social media accounts driven often by bots, robots, on social media spaces. And these sock puppets, these fake, often anonymous social media accounts, can be used to either support or attack particular political candidates or points of view or campaign positions. You know, we're living in sort of real time here. The New York Times actually just did 2 Sundays ago a really actually brilliant for the New York Times 3-page feature story in the Sunday Times about what they're calling now the follower factory, how celebrities, politicians can manufacture fake followers by hiring third-party corporations who specialize in the creation of sock puppets. And they're calling this phenomenon the hashtag follower factory, the literal manufacturing, in many cases, of millions of sock puppets, fake social media accounts that are unleashed into our digital spaces to support or attack particular campaigns or candidates or what have you. So the term sock puppet, or bot is another word that people are using, is its own filter, because to recognize the power of fake social media accounts by the thousands, the millions, which are kind of at play now in our news and information culture, is a really important filter to be aware of. I know that the Democrats and the Republicans before the election were guilty of using sock puppets for various information warfare and news generation purposes.
And Rob Williams, it's also the case at Project Censored, we've covered several stories going back almost a decade that look at fake social media counts. In fact, one story we did a number of years ago was on people within the U.S. military creating 10 to 20 accounts that they would specifically manage, and that their goal was to follow people. Rob Williams, that means that, you know, if you and I are on Facebook, it's the picture of some allegedly alluring or enticing person we don't know suddenly friending us from nowhere. And we see that they're also friends with three other people that we know, and we look on their page and there's nothing there, and we immediately dismiss them and move them out of our way. Because the first thing that comes to mind is like, this is a fake account. This is espionage in a certain way. But it's also through social media, we're giving access to the deep state. We're just giving it away.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, a single sock puppet account isn't really a problem. But when you can replicate anonymous fake social media accounts by the hundreds or thousands or even millions, and then deploy these through bots in targeted news information ways, that's when it becomes a problem. So that's our 10th filter. And then the final filter is one that kind of is an umbrella filter, I think. And that is what Chomsky and Herman in 1988 called the filter of ideology. And you mentioned it at the very beginning of the show, but anti-communism was the defining ideology of the late Cold War period, right, in the 1980s. It was an existential threat to the so-called Western capitalist democratic way of life, to U.S. civilization as a whole. And anti-communism as an ideology has morphed, I think, into what we might call maybe two sides of the same coin, terrorism on kind of the evil face, and then neoliberalism as a kind of a rabid form of corporate capitalism on the flip side as being, you know, all that is good and right in the world. So that filter of ideology, terrorism slash neoliberalism, has replaced the anti-communism slash capitalism binary as a powerful ideological filter. And I know your listeners know this, but it was really Thatcher and Reagan who took neoliberalism out of the pages of Ayn Rand and moved it into policy in the 1980s. And then it was, of course, picked up by the globalists, the Clintons, the Obamas in the U.S.
Well, the Bushes, the Trumps, all of them.
The Bushes, the Trumps, of course, yeah. And it's a bipartisan phenomenon.
Strange that while anti-communism has sort of waned, even though we clearly have anti-socialist tendencies, while anti-communism has waned, anti-Russia has not.
Russia is, anti-Russian sentiment. The new McCarthyism is back, even though the Soviet Union collapsed.
Rob Williams, at the end of your piece, you have a great quote from Herman, one of his monthly review piece from 2017 on fake news in Russia. He asks, qui bono, right? The mainstream, the corporate mainstream news media never ask qui bono, right? Who benefits?
Who benefits?
Follow the money. Yes. And in the news industry, right, this is something that's key. And in fact, the core really of the 21st century digital age propaganda model of news really is a great extension of the work that they did back in the 1980s.
Yeah, we hope so. And it's really been a collaborative effort. And our hope is that Project Censored and Vermont Independent and the Action Coalition for Media Education and the Media Education Foundation and others will really work together to revive the Chomsky-Herman model, bring it up to speed for the digital age, and really use it as a powerful antidote to fake news, to propaganda, to disinformation, and really use it as a way to help all of us understand why we get the news we get, quote-unquote news we get so much of the time, and how we can do better. And many of us, I think, are working hard to do better, each in our own way, in terms of delivering news that we can really use rather than news abuse.
Indeed, Rob Williams, professor, activist, author. You can see his latest work at projectcensored.org. The Post-Truth World, Reviving the Propaganda Model of News for Our Digital Age. Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us today again on the Project Censored Show.
Mickey, it's been a real pleasure, and thanks for all the work that you and your team at Project Censored do.
It's an honor to work with you, Rob, and I would like to dedicate today's show, the Project Censored Show, to the late, great Edward Herman. I would also like to dedicate it to the late, great Robert Perry, Consortium News, who helped break the Iran-Contra case, who died not long ago, just a couple weeks ago. And last but not least, I want to dedicate it to a good friend of mine, a former student and intern, who passed away tragically 2 weeks ago. His name was Thomas Field. He worked with us on Censored 2018, a true news junkie and historian. He's in chapters 2 and 3 of the book and was working on a chapter with us for the next Censored book, and just a very untimely passing. And I would argue was really up and coming and in the running for one of the great great media commentators. And so, again, Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey. We'll talk soon.
All right, take care.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, executive producer, along with Peter Phillips. And we founded the Project Censored Show back in 2010. Our executive producer is Anthony Fest. Our producer of today's program is Dennis Murphy from the studios of KPCA in Petaluma. Mitch Scorza also is a producer with the Project Censored Show down at California State East Bay, who works with Nicholas Baham III and Nolan Higdon as co-hosts, along with Amy Casey. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and other social media. Special thanks to Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York, and all of our shows are archived online at projectcensored.org. You can also like us and support us through our Patreon page. We'll see you next time.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, incomes, debts, jobs, for ourselves, for us in the future, for our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and my hope is that that prepared me well to present to you each week this analysis of some of the major events in the economic lives we lead. I want to begin this program by thanking various hosts that I have visited during the month of February 2018. I want to start with the Chapo Trap House. They did a really wonderful interview that was lively and interesting. And for those of you who know the important work that they do, Chapo Trap House, take a look. You might find the interview they did with us as exciting and interesting as we found it. I also want to thank the people in Praxis Peace, a local group in Sonoma, California, on the other side of the country. And they were our hosts when we spoke, Dr. Harriet Fraud, who often appears on this program, and myself, at the Sonoma Community Center. And finally, I want to thank KPFA, the Pacifica station in the Bay Area of California, where I returned in order to do the annual fundraiser at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, as I have done every year for the last quite a few. It's a wonderful experience for me to meet the very people that I try to reach, the people who hear me on the radio and then want to kind of have a in-person and close-up interaction. Just want to let you know it's as interesting and exciting to me as it is, I hope, to all of you. So let's jump into the economic updates for our time. You must have noticed, as I have, that every time the capitalist political economy that we live in, an enterprise-driven economic system of stores, factories, and offices on the one hand, and the government, which is dependent on those enterprises for much of its revenue and for the economy to keep going, without which there wouldn't be much toleration for the political system either. And you must have noticed, as I have, that when that economic system breaks down, The place where almost everyone turns, real quickly, to solve the problem is to the government. That's what happened in the 1930s when we took a real dive. It's what happened again in the bailouts that came right after the crash of 2008. So isn't it interesting that the very corporate leaders who turn to the government to save them when their system doesn't work turn around and blame the government as if it were the source of all the problems rather than them? Of course, it's very clever, right? Because if we're all afflicted by unemployment and all the difficulties of a capitalist system, it would be dangerous for the people who actually run it if they were the targets of our upset. So it's important to have a scapegoat, to make somebody else do it. And the government has been the scapegoat of choice for right-wingers and for people who love capitalism and cannot get their heads around the idea that it's a system with a lot of problems. Nothing illustrates this more than the fishing industry. That's right, something we don't talk about very often, but we need to. Fishing is a dying industry. Not long ago we outfished freshwater, but now we have done what a few years ago would have been thought impossible. We have literally destroyed ocean fishing as well. We've overfished. We've fished in unsustainable ways. Why? Because fishing companies, here we go now, have profit as the bottom line. Fishing companies are competing with one another all the time. It makes no sense for one fishing company to hold back on grabbing all the fish it can, because if it does, it only creates the business for a competitor. So in that kind of a situation, if you let the private enterprise system go, it will do what it has now done, fished out the oceans, made fish difficult, made fish often scarce, made fish too expensive for many people to afford, and to literally make them disappear. What we have is a failure to use the government to control the failure of the private fishing industry. It's a cautionary tale about how capitalism works. The second economic update for today has to do with malls. That's right, those either beautiful or hideous collections of stores that we all know about, especially here in the United States. And as I have been telling you in recent broadcasts, huge numbers, thousands of malls are empty now. Weeds are growing up through the asphalt of the parking lot. People don't go anymore. Other uses are being examined for the empty stores that haven't been able to find a tenant for years now. But I was interested to learn in a recent Bloomberg story that some malls are doing just fine. I want to mention some of them to you. The Americana Manhasset, wealthy North Shore of New York's Long Island. The Forum Shops at Caesars in Las Vegas. The Grove Mall in Los Angeles, and perhaps the most elegant of them all, the Bal Harbor Shops in Bal Harbor, Florida. They're doing great. They're expanding. They're cramming more stores into their space. They're renovating to make it even more elegant and attractive to consumers and to local wealthy people. What's remarkable is you often don't have to go more than, oh, a 10-minute drive from one of these malls to see one of the other kind of malls. Bal Harbor, it's literally the mall at 163rd Street, just up the road, which can show you the abandoned mall, the dead mall. In other words, what we're seeing is a mirror to our economy. A tiny number of high-paid, high-priced malls doing very well in an economy that has made the rich richer. And the vast majority of malls that serve the rest of us are dying. As I say, it's a mirror, but it's a mirror with a certain poetic way of teaching us something. And to show you how profound the mirror is, Let me tell you about the most recent expansion of the Bal Harbour Shops Mall. It turns out that right behind the mall was a 70-year-old Congregational church, right behind the parking lot. It had a famous large sign called Worship This Sunday, the sign for the church by the sea, as it was called. Wow. Recent months, the mall purchased the church, purchased the land on which the church sits, and has torn down the church to make room for more wealthy expenditures by the wealthy people who enjoy the wealthy Bal Harbour Shops Mall. There's something even more poetic about the elimination of a church so that the wealthy can have yet more in the way of an expensive mall. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum for our third economic update. And here I'm indebted to Matt Brunig of the People's Policy Project. They do interesting economic analysis there, and I found this one particularly interesting. Using the Survey of Consumer Finances, a very important government document giving data about our economy, Matt Brunig calculated young families. He took a look at families with heads of the family below the age of 35 years. And he said, I want to look at the young people of America and ask what their situation is. How much wealth do they have? What's their situation? What can we say about them as a particular group? And what he found was so arresting for me that I want to share it with you. He looked into the net worth of these families. The net worth basically means you add up the assets that such families have and you subtract from that the debts they have to see how much their net worth is, what they own less what they owe. And he made a further decision. He excluded vehicles, because vehicles lose their value very quickly and so really aren't part of what you ought to think of as a family's wealth. Okay, 2016, what was the net worth, the median net worth of young families, families below 35 years of age for the head of the family? Well, as I say, this blew my mind. Median means 50% of the families have more than this net worth I'm about to tell you about, and 50% have less. So the median net worth of young families in America in 2016, not counting their vehicles, was, here we go, $1,250. That's what the median. Half the young families of America have less than $1,250. What does that mean? It means that young people have no fallback, nothing to see them through an unexpected expense, a sick child, a lost job, a divorce, you name it, all the things that life can throw at you. Half the young families have $1,250 or less to cope with all of that. Nothing better gets across the lack of a recovery in the United States since 2008, or the failure of a capitalist economic system to provide for the young people that are going to be our future and the children they're bringing into the world, than to tell us, as Mr. Brunig's work has done, what they're living on. I've also told you in past broadcasts about the bizarre decisions in the state of Kansas, where they cut taxes on business drastically, they cut taxes on the rich drastically, and promised the people of Kansas, the Republican governor did, Mr. Brownback, that by doing this cutting of taxes, They would stimulate the economy of Kansas and provide lots of more jobs. And with the people having more jobs, they'd pay more taxes and the government would be in great shape. Those were the promises. None of that came to pass. Kansas did not undo its unemployment. It has had higher unemployment than most other states in the United States. None of the good things happened. I now want to tell you about a state really nearby, Oklahoma. Oklahoma, very like Kansas, governed by a Republican conservative who cuts taxes. And here are some of the consequences of the cut taxes. By the way, cut taxes particularly for the fracking companies, the oil and gas companies that are the only part of the Oklahoma economy not in deep trouble, and even they have had a rough few years. Oklahoma has taken things to a stage that I need to talk to you about because it is so severe. Here's the first thing. In many parts of the state of Oklahoma, they have cut the length of the school week from 5 days to four. The weekend in these places continues through Monday. Why? Because they don't have enough money, they say, to pay school teachers. And the salaries they offer, among the lowest in the United States, very few states offer as little as Oklahoma. The only perks they can give to their teachers for paying them so little is to give them a day off. Let me take that a little bit further with you, if you don't mind. What do the teachers do on the Monday they don't have to go to school? It turns out they have jobs to fill in their income. Half of them roughly work at Walmarts, and the other half in local restaurants. Oh. And what happens to the families whose kids don't go to school on Monday? Well, they just have to make do in whatever way they can. Did that solve the state's problem? No, it turns out it didn't. It turns out that even if you don't make someone work on Monday, giving them a chance to go get paid at Walmart, which has some of the lowest pay scales in the United States, or at a local restaurant, and that doesn't pay well most of the time either, particularly in Midwestern states like Oklahoma, that you're still paying your teachers, even with that, way too little. And guess what? Which should surprise nobody. Teachers who aren't in overabundance in America don't want to teach in Oklahoma. So they have a shortage despite having shortened the work week for the school kids and the teachers. And how have they handled that? You'll love this. I'll have to read it to you. The shortage of teachers in the school districts have found, here we go now, 1,850 adults without the necessary qualifications who have been given emergency certifications and placed in classrooms. Penny Risley, the principal of an elementary school in Wagoner, Oklahoma, said to the media, "This year I emergency certified my secretary." As an economist, I am required to teach in every university I've ever been that the future and well-being of the American economy in the world depends above all else on the quality and the quantity of educated young people that enter the labor market. For us to be responding to the current economic situation by savagely cutting the quality and the quantity of teaching we do to our young people is the equivalent in economics of shooting yourself in the foot. It is irrational. It is damaging in a way that cannot be repaired for the tens of thousands of young people in Oklahoma going through this kind of experience. It's actually a kind of a stunning demonstration, and it needs some explanation. And here's how it works. When the capitalist economic system gets itself into difficulty, with economic downturns of the sort, for example, we had in 2008, and which are regular occurrences with a capitalist economy, something has to happen. And what typically happens is that we turn to the government, as I pointed out earlier, and we ask the government to help people out as they suffer with unemployment, with cut work weeks for their kids' schools, and all the other outflow of economic troubles. And then we often see Democrats, liberals, come into office because they're the ones who push the government should help out. But of course, the Republicans and the business community don't want the government to do too much for fear that everybody will get the idea, maybe we should have the government do more. Maybe the government should prevent these collapses from happening in the first place. So they hold everything back. So the Democrats, who try to do something, can't do very much because they don't challenge the system. They just try to get a few things done. They're held back. And eventually people say, gee, these Democrats are not doing enough for us. And in their anger, they go back to the Republicans. Great, say the Republicans. The real problem is the government. Let us starve the beast. Let us cut the taxes so the government doesn't do all the bad things it does. So they cut the government, which then what? Throws people back into suffering, deregulates what businesses can do, leading us into the next economic downturn where we repeat the whole game. So we get a politics, which is America. Oscillation between the Republicans for a while until they blow it up. Then we give it to the Democrats for a while until they can't deliver what it is they promised. Then we angrily go back to the Republicans. That's all Mr. Trump is. He's the latest wave in this oscillation. And guess what the Democrats are doing? Waiting for him to cause so much difficulty, so much disruption, so much suffering, that there'll be a wave the other way in one of the next elections. We're not solving our problems this way. We're just kicking the can down the road as we oscillate back and forth. Before I continue, I want to remind you that we maintain two websites that we invite you to make use of. They're open 24/7. They have no charge attached to your using them. One is rdwolf with two Fs .com, and the other one is Democracy at Work. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Both of these websites allow you to communicate to us and tell us what you like and don't like about this program. Both of these websites allow you, with a click of a mouse, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And for those of you that listen to this program as a radio show or a podcast, if you're interested in seeing it as a television program, we invite you to go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/economic update, the name of this program, and you can see it as a television program. We maintain and update these websites. They're for you. They're a way for you to partner with us, to share what we provide in the way of analysis and information with other people. And that's exactly what we try to do. You can do that too. And then we will proceed and be twice as effective as we might otherwise be if we went separately. Okay. Let me turn next to a place in the world that I go to nowadays because they are crafting new initiatives. And so once again, I'm in Great Britain. And once again, I want to talk to you about the British Labour Party. They're sort of the rough equivalent of the Democrats over there. And this time I want to talk to you about one of their leaders, not the one who gets all the attention, Jeremy Corbyn, but rather one of his close associates, John McDonnell. He's announced a plan. He says that the people will be better served, the British people, with their water needs, their energy needs, their rail systems. He proposes that these are not working real well. They're overpriced by the private companies that run them. They're not well maintained, sometimes not even safe. And we can do better than private capitalist enterprises. What does he propose? Classic. And what's interesting is not that he proposes something new, because this isn't new, but that it's becoming very popular in Britain, which is why the polls there show that if there were an election today, the Labour Party would win. He proposes the renationalization of water, energy, and rail in Great Britain. The government is going to take them over, and he explains in public speeches it will cost nothing. Here's how it works. Right now, he says, the water company, just to take them as an example, a private company, borrows lots of money, provides water to the British people, and charges the British people for the water enough money to pay the cost of delivering the water, to pay the cost of the money borrowed to do all of it, the interest charges, and on top of that, a profit distributed to the shareholders of the water company. Says Mr. McDonald, if the government takes it over, here's how it'll do it. The government will take over the enterprise, and it will pay the private companies in government bonds, no cash, a debt the government promises to pay over 5, 10, or 15 years. And then he points out, we will immediately be able to lower the price of the water we deliver to every British home. Why? Because we have to recover with the prices we charge what it costs to bring the water, like a private company, what it costs to pay off the debt that the government undertook to get the private water company into the government's hands. But we don't have to raise the price to pay anybody any dividends, shareholders, because there aren't any. So we can lower the price. We don't have to charge as much as a private enterprise does, because our job as the government is to deliver the water, not to make a profit in the way a private enterprise does. We won't have any shareholders to pay off. The point is not whether you agree or disagree. The point is to understand this kind of thinking as a solution to the problems of the British economy is becoming mainstream again, despite all the efforts to demonize and dismiss this approach, this kind of thinking, both in England and the United States, for many decades now. The wind, the economic and political wind, is changing. The final economic update that we will have time for today has me listening closely to the budget director for President Trump, a man named Mulvaney. Some of you may have heard some of the things he says. Here's what he admitted over the last few days, publicly. Yes, he said, it's true, we cut taxes dramatically, $1 trillion or more. Yes, it's true, he said. On top of that, we're spending more money, $300-400 billion more. And yes, he said, if you put together a massive tax cut together with a massive increase in spending, obviously the only way the government can do that is if it borrows the money it's no longer raising in taxes to spend even more than it was spending before. And then he makes the interesting admission that I want to make sure you all understand. Speaking as if he were explaining this to children, Mr. Mulvaney says, yes, of course, if suddenly the government has to borrow $1 trillion that it didn't have to borrow before the tax cut, that's going to drive up interest rates because the government's going to have to persuade people to lend it money, even though the government is more in debt now than it has been for decades. What is Mr. Mulvaney telling us? He's telling us that we can expect to see, now his words, interest rate spikes. Well, folks, there's the admission. If the interest rates spike up, the cost of buying a home shoots up because that's what shapes a mortgage. The cost of buying a car shoots up because of the interest over the years you take to pay off the car. Ditto for your credit card, ditto for your student's college borrowing. Wow. Turns out that cutting taxes for corporations and the rich and spending more on the Defense Department is going to whack you right in your pocketbook. That part was left out in all the debates and all the discussion. Mr. Mulvaney, after the fact, smilingly lets us know. You live in a system that doesn't work for you. And part of my job is to make sure it doesn't blow by you without your being aware of it. We've reached the end of the first half of this program. Thank you very much for listening. Please stay with us as we move to a very interesting interview about a very important part of the global economy. Stay right with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update. It is my pleasure today to welcome someone who's been a friend of mine for 30 years, maybe more. We've been friends around a shared interest, and that interest has been the American labor movement, something which was important and big when we were young, and that isn't either of those anymore. And that's indeed what we want to talk about. We want to talk about what happened to the American labor movement, why that happened, what its meanings are, what its consequences have been, and what might turn that around. So let me introduce him. His name is Charles, or as we all call him, Charlie Fabian. He was born many years ago in New York City, the child of partial immigrants. His father was the first member of his family to be born in the United States. He went to school in Indiana, got married, moved to Massachusetts, and began to get involved, partly as a student and partly as a young worker, in the labor movement. He eventually moved to New Haven, Connecticut, where he spent much of the rest of his life, working both politically but also with the Communications Workers of America in one union, with the Connecticut State AFL-CIO as a director of education for that statewide union of unions, you might say. And then the bulk of his time was spent working for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, Council 4. He worked there in Connecticut for 20 years. And his job was to represent workers in disputes with their employers, working with activists in the union to change the union, make it work better for the people involved in it. Back in 2011, he was hired by Local 1199, of SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, in Connecticut. He participated in a number of campaigns fighting back against layoffs and service cuts by the then Republican Governor John Rowland, whose later career included quite some years, if I recall, in jail for his efforts. And he finished his union career, you might say, as a staff person, a staff representative for Local 2001 of SEIU, retiring in February of last year, 2017. So Charlie Fabian has been an activist in the labor movement for much of the last several decades, and so is in a wonderful position to talk with me about what happened to the labor movement and why. So I want you all, please, to join me in welcoming Charlie Fabian to Economic Update. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, so let me jump right into it and ask you the questions that I talked to you about before, because they are so important that, in a way, they're automatic. So let's start. If it is true, as all the statistics tell us, that in the private sector of the American economy, something on the order of under 7% of workers are in a union or represented by a union, that marks a decline from what I think was roughly a third of workers in the private sector back in the 40s and 50s. So the last half century have seen what can't be called by any politeness other than a collapse in the significance and importance of labor unions in the lives of working people. So tell me, from your experience, how did this feel? How have workers experienced this? What has it meant to them? What did you pick up in countless conversations and in your work as to the meaning of unions that might let you shed light for us on what this has all been about?
The biggest impact of that dwindling density rate results in workers suffering job security issues, always being threatened by their employer to curtail their efforts with that employer. Otherwise, we'll close up shop, you know, we'll move stuff to a more friendly environment. And so then that results in pressure on unions to not be as aggressive and take, not fight as hard for better wages, better pension benefits, better health insurance, all of those things which a union tries to improve for workers. They're faced with the problem of, in a layperson's term, not being able to deliver for their members. And that it's a problem primarily, I think, in that unions during their peak density periods sort of bought into the deal, you know, don't push too hard and things will be fine. You know, that came at a time when the United States economy ruled the world. So, you know, there was that ability to ease into that system. As the U.S. economy got threatened, the deal at home began to change. And so pressure came on workers, and the density issue has always been a problem for unions, even back in the late 40s, early 50s, when it was at its peak. There were portions of this country that had no union representation. And I think, interestingly enough, it's those same geographical areas that show the same traces, you know. New York State, primarily probably driven by New York City, has the highest labor representation rate, 20%. You take the southern tier of this country, and unionization rates are below 5%. There was a recent, you know, fall 2017 report by Bureau of Labor Statistics, and one of the charts showed this nifty map of the United States based on labor density. And if you compared it to the war room at CNN on election night, it would fit right over the red state, blue state divide in this country.
Right.
So, you know, that's always been a problem. Historically in Connecticut, the textile industry was a major employer. And right up until the time I moved to New Haven, there were textile manufacturing firms in New Haven, yes, major employers. The South was always a place where when things got too difficult for northern-based employers to make their
profits,
necessary profits, they would close up and head down south.
But that, if I can interrupt, that means, I want to go back to your first point. So it was very real and realistic for workers and unions to be fearful of that threat, that if you don't accept the deal, the little bit we are prepared to give you, you get nothing. Your choice is between, as I like to say, low wages or none at all. And that's the name of the game. And as long as you didn't organize the South and the other areas, you were stuck. And even if you had, then they would have gone out of the country. We know they would have because that's what they've been doing.
They did.
Okay, let me ask an obvious question. How have workers resisted? What, in other words, all workers aren't sheep. They didn't all go along with this decline, you know, happily, passively. Were there pushbacks, and what happened to them?
Well, in Connecticut, and I'll start with the private sector, Connecticut and other states in the, I'm going to scratch my head, early 80s, started agitating for what we called runaway shop legislation. The legislation, as any sort of law happens in this country, never gets you where you want to be. But in Connecticut, legislation got passed that required employers to at least give 60 days notice that they were going to cut you.
Right.
And that happened in a couple of other states, and eventually it wound up in federal legislation. I think it's called the WARN, W-A-R-N Act, got passed in 88 or something like that. And, you know, again, as I said, with sort of the labor movement buying into the make peace deal in the 40s and 50s, that legislation didn't really solve the problem of workers losing their jobs. They just got advance notice.
Huh.
That was one way workers fought back, and it was a way for workers and unions to agitate around the problem.
It's interesting because I just want to underscore what you're saying. So what the workers fought for was an improvement. At least you got 60 days notice. You could plan. You didn't have that story of being told Friday on your way out of the plant that you didn't need to come back on Monday because it was gone. So it was good, but it didn't solve the problem. It was palliative. It made the problem less awful, but it didn't solve the problem.
Correct. And because the problem is, part of the problem is allowing the capitalist economy to do whatever it wants with workers, you know. And I thought of it this morning on the ride down, you know. You can compare it a little bit to like a water balloon, you know. You push it, but it bulges somewhere else.
Right.
And so when workers in Connecticut push here for better wages and benefits, well, the bulge goes somewhere else. And it might be down south, or it might be, you know, Central America or Asia or anywhere else except where the balloon is getting pushed. The capitalists have a great way, not to say that they don't fight back. I mean, one of the things that may come as a surprise to people is that this country has had no problem killing workers when they've fought for unionization, better wages, better benefits. famous shooting by thugs hired by the Ford Motor Company during the CIO organizing days. They shot and killed organizers. The attempt to organize to steel mills in the 30s and 40s was probably the bloodiest
right.
20th century organizing effort.
Right.
So they pushed back, but more likely they liked to go somewhere else because pushing back and fighting back. A movie quote jumped into my head.
Yeah.
Blood's a costly thing.
There's always been those employers who will do violence, but there's always been the other ones who'd say to them, don't be crazy, buy your way out of this. In the end, it's less dangerous because you never know if you push that violence, it can come back and bite you too. And so there's this, anyway.
And so that's sort of the private sector, you know.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about the public, because I know you've had more experience.
And, you know, a recent issue in New Haven, Connecticut, which is where I live, back in 2011, the Board of Education decided that their custodial services were eating up too much of the budget. And so they decided to try and contract out part of the services. And the union in that case primarily tried to bargain at the table and use a process in law in Connecticut called interest arbitration, where the parties go before a supposed neutral and present their positions. Well, the union lost that fight, and the Board of Ed was able to contract out over 150 jobs, roughly half of the workforce for that union. That fall, AFSCME and the major union in New Haven, the Yale Locals 34 and 35, decided to run candidates for the Board of Alders, the legislative body in New Haven, and they took over roughly, they got their candidates elected in more than three quarters of the legislative seats. The only candidate not able to win was a candidate who, besides being endorsed by the unions, got endorsed by the Democratic Party, and that person lost. all of the other candidates backed by the unions had to primary and were not endorsed by the Democratic Party. So it was a real achievement by the labor movement.
Right. They displaced the Democrats.
Yes. And they ran as Democrats.
But they displaced the machine
And because there's no other party for workers to participate in.
Right.
And so while that didn't fix the contracting out problem, that was a reaction to that effort. And, you know, having a worker's voice on the Board of Alders has helped, you know, in some of the labor struggles in New Haven. So that's a way that public sector workers can try and balance the scales to some degree.
Because they can go into the political arena, run for office, and then they become the other side at the table.
Yes.
And the lesson here can't be lost on our audience that if the two parties don't do what mass of the majority of people who are workers want, then it might occur to workers to take some political power into their own hands. And I wish there were more stories, or maybe I should say there are all these stories. We just don't have a chance to hear that they actually work, that they're tried by workers, and that those workers can succeed in using the political power. Let me ask you the starkest question I can think of. And here I would like you to think about both the public and the private, since you've experienced them both. Are you worried that the labor movement, organized labor, unions, could be disappearing in the United States? Could be
if the graph goes for 50 years always in a down thing, at some point it goes below zero and we don't have any anymore. Is that something that occurs to people that they think about? Is that something in the cards?
It's scary. I mean, the fact that unions have been, besides the declining number of members, unions and the slight ideology that we put forward has been under attack for a while, and it's getting worse. So will it disappear? You know, workers have gone through very tough times in this country, dating back to the first time anybody had to pick up a hammer and a saw.
Right.
But workers have managed to find a way to eventually fight back. You know, I don't want to give a labor history lesson to everybody, but, you know, some of the high points after very serious low points, as bad, maybe even worse than we currently experience, you know, the industrial workers of the world around the turn of the century did a fantastic job of organizing what would be called unskilled workers, you know, laborers, primarily miners, you know, and they pushed the bubble in a different direction or the water balloon in a different direction. Then in the 19-teens and 20s, you know, the heyday of capitalism. Before the crash, the labor movement was nothing to speak of, you know, represented small craft trades, and that was about it. Well, something pushed and gave, and activists were working in these huge factories, and the established labor movement, there were elements within it that said the established approach to representing workers isn't working for us right now. And they split. They actually left the Federation and developed an alternative approach to organizing. And there was a huge growth in represented workers.
Yeah, the greatest in American, that CIO in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
You know, the greatest unionization drive the country had ever seen.
And, you know, they had to take different tactics, different strategies. The auto workers, you know, different political elements within that union working to gain representation. I hope they're famous, sit-down strikes, you know, where they actually took over the tools and didn't let the boss have access to them.
Right.
That led to, you know, great successes in the organizing drive. So we've had bad times. Workers have found a way to respond, and we're in a really bad era. And I've been an optimist all my life. I always think that if we keep talking to people, we'll move them. And I think the established labor movement needs to, if it doesn't change its tactics drastically, then it will disappear. It will become a nothingness. But that doesn't mean workers won't adopt new tactics and strategies. And if you're not going to change, get out of the way, because we're coming.
All right, I have to ask you, Charlie, what would you hope for? What would you think might stir or begin or give momentum to a new wave of what you say makes you an optimist? What would you hope to see, imagine coming? What do you see the seeds of, maybe, of changing this story, of seeing another upsurge where working people have powerful organizations?
Well, I would hope that the established unions, because they have resources, would devote those resources to a different kind of organizing tactic or strategy. When I referenced the custodians in New Haven, I live in New Haven, I worked for that union, and yet during that bargaining table fight, nobody organized community members. And so I think unions need to take some of their resources. While it's important to organize workers at the workplace, a lot of our fights, we need to change the socio-political dynamic going on. And so I would hope and look for unions to devote more of their resources to having members or staff people go out and, like other grassroots organizations, go knocking on doors in neighborhoods and finding out what our neighbors want and need and making changes so that unions or workers can be a part of that movement to stopping the assault on the environment, stopping the assault on women's health issues. You know, there are a number of progressive efforts being made by people to fight back on those things, but there's not a concentrated grouping all moving forward with the same ideology. What makes me optimistic is the fact that even after the election of one of the worst people ever as president, it was within months that, I don't know what the number was, but I participated in the New York City march in February of 17.
The women's.
The women's march. And while it had a specific focus, there were lots of support elements there. And that, you know, in a dismal time, that gave me hope. And, you know, another personal anecdote, you know, my inbox gets squashed by all this stuff. You know, it's almost like a spam container now. But some of the primarily green ecological groups, now whenever there's a political uproar around the Trump administration, they're jumping on the bandwagon almost faster than anyone else. And so maybe that identification by everybody as we've got to all push in the same direction, gets legs, takes off, runs. Sadly enough, I don't get as many emails, you know, from a union public campaign around those issues.
It is interesting, though, to pick up just on the last point. It is interesting that this economic system puts the mass of workers in loggerhead relationship with the employers so that in effect, the system itself regenerates the logic in the minds of the workers. If we get together, if we stand together, we can have a better deal here than what we're offered by this system. It's an embedded radicalism. Thank you very much, Charlie, for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I hope people will think about their own relationship to the labor movement the way you've described it. And thank you all for watching and listening. It's been a pleasure. I want to ask you again to partner with us by making use of this program and our websites, rdwolfwith2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to thank our old partner, truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis. And I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, How I Became an Activist. How does someone change or learn or find the courage to speak out? The Unitarian Fellowship Hall in Berkeley, California, had a speaker series in the early 2000s on how to become an activist. Michael Parenti was one of the best known in that series. Michael Parenti grew up in a poor working-class Italian community in New York City. When he received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962, he was the success and pride of his family. He risked and ended his academic career when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam. Ultimately, the choice he made then was a good one. Unrestrained by academic conservatism, he was free to write and speak his mind. He devoted himself full-time to writing, public speaking, and political activism. He's the author of 23 books and many more articles. His works have been translated into at least 18 languages. Parenti's writings cover a wide range of subjects: U.S. politics, culture, ideology, political economy, imperialism, fascism, communism, democratic socialism, conservative judicial activism, religion, history, news and entertainment media, technology, environment, sexism, racism, and the wars on Iraq and Yugoslavia. Perhaps his most influential book is Democracy for the Few, now in its 9th edition, a critical analysis of U.S. society, economy, and political institutions. Even though Parenti has retired from public speaking, his vast treasure of writings and analysis shows up in blogs and quotes by other writers, an indication of how timeless his writing is. Michael Parenti is famously known for rarely talking about himself, and this talk about how he became an activist was a rare event. Here's Michael Parenti.
When people speak about how they became what they are, they usually refer to a melange of influences and issues. You know, then there was this teacher who did this. I'll do the same, but I'd like us to keep something in mind. And that is, we're not just a mixture of these influences. You bring your own mental labor power, your own emotive concern. You bring your own innate energy and insight to an issue and a cause. And this adds to our collective impact and our collective empowerment. People sometimes say to me, they don't ask, they say, you're red diaper, right? You're red diaper. You know, I guess assuming you hold so fast to these views, you must have got them through your mother's milk, you know. And I say, well, no, I'm not. My consciousness and my activism was arrived at through a very circuitous process, mostly self-education, mostly undoing my miseducation. And, you know, quite often, the most important dialogue we have is with ourselves. So remember that. It's an interior dialogue, at least on a lot of occasions. At least it is for me. We do have evidence of people who have never had an interior dialogue. But they're all in power right now. I always thought that red diaper babies are very lucky. I'll give you two examples of red diaper babies that I know. One of them is my son, Christian. The other red diaper baby I know, I think he's red diaper, is Ralph Nader. He says, my father, Ralph Nader's talking, he says, my father, and I'm saying, hey, Ralph had a father. I just didn't think of him in those terms, but of course he had a father. He said, my father once said to me, Ralph, he said, capitalism doesn't fail because it always has socialism to bail it out. It's a very good insight. Namely, that means that, and you see it happening today, that the corporations have the bailouts of the collective wealth. They get, in fact, bailouts. They're called bailouts when they're into a bankruptcy. They get tax write-offs. They get direct subsidies. They get research and development subsidies. They get export subsidies. They get loan guarantees. I mean, you can go on. I don't even have the list. So they feed off the collectivity that they're constantly denouncing and saying collectivism, individual initiative. They've got their hands in the public trough right up to their elbows and their necks. Now, in my home was relatively politically impoverished. It was a blue-collar, Italian-American, working-class, low-income. We were really poor. Money was a constant problem and a concern, which itself is a political lesson that one kind of learns in one's gut, really. Not in this society, not that much in your head. I mean, there were some good knockdown, drag-out fights about Mussolini and the war. I remember those between my uncles and various people. And then there was the depression and the poverty and the fear of that depression. But generally, it was a rather provincial existence. I mean, there was a candy store and the handball court and the backyards and the street. I was a street kid. I lived in the streets. I learned to fight. There were a lot of fist fights. We used to beat the brains out of each other. So when people ask me, well, how did you get from this this neighborhood and how did you get all the way up to Yale? I always say, I didn't get all the way up to Yale. I don't think it was an ascent. I got across to Yale, as you put it. I said, but I can sum it up in one word, and that's dogs. That is, my grandfather had a brown dog, and he named him Brownie. My Uncle Nick got a white dog, big fluffy white dog. He named him Whitey. And we got a dog that had spots on it, and everybody called him Spotty. And that was the level of imagination in my family. and that's when I knew I had to get the hell out and go to school. The other explanation is I didn't do it all on my own. How did you do this all on your own? I didn't. The other explanation is that it wasn't self-made. I mean, this society is full of mythologies about self-made man. You're a self-made man. Nobody's self-made. I could never have gotten close to getting any kind of education if there hadn't been, for generations, untold numbers of people, like a lot of the people in this room, whose names I don't even know, who fought for the principle of public education. Now, I was just three generations back from not only a grade school education, but a public education at the college level. That was the only way I went to college. In fact, I couldn't even go to college at first. I'll get to that in a minute. But what we're saying here, and then even pressuring for the stipends and the fellowships at Yale, I couldn't have gone to Yale if I hadn't gotten support from them. So there's two things we got to keep in mind here. First, in anybody's socialization process, there's a self-generated component to all accomplishment. There is a certain thing that the person is doing, synthesizing everything I said before and putting some creative input into it. And there are other times when we so focus on the individual accomplishment that we overlook this collective effort and the social context that it takes place. All individual human endeavor is also a collective social endeavor. When I was in high school, I began to get vaguely interested in politics, and I thought of myself as a Republican. I thought that would get a real laugh, but I guess it didn't. And that's because the only thing I read was the New York Daily News, which was a Republican right-wing rag, and the New York Journal American, which was a Republican rag. I was very afraid that communism was going to be taking over the whole world. The very first presidential. Politics in our house, I guess, was electoral, as it is in most houses. People start giving it attention when an election's coming around. And the first presidential election I remember where I really was reading and following it a bit was the 1948 election between Harry Truman and Tom Dewey. I remember one day my father just saying, it was just I and my mother sitting there. He said, Truman's finished. Truman, he's gotten kicked one side down the other. He's falling apart. He'll never get reelected. He's a loser. We might as well vote for Dewey, who's been governor of the state. If we got to make a change, Dewey isn't so bad. And my mother sort of nodding and all that. And then on election day, she came back from the polls and she took me aside and she said, Michael, she said, don't tell your daddy, but I voted for Truman. And I know what it was. You know, everybody predicted that Truman was going to lose, and hers was a compassion vote. My mother was very compassionate. She was afraid that maybe nobody in America would vote for Truman, and so she wanted to make sure that Truman got a vote, at least some votes. And so a little while later, I saw my father. I said, Dad, who'd you vote for? And he said, hey, I said, I didn't know he was on the ballot. Pop, who'd you vote for? He said, the goddamn Republicans. You know, if they get in, we'll have another depression. I voted for Truman. But don't tell your mother. So, I mean, you give a teenager this kind of weaponry. The very first chance I could, at dinner, when they were both sitting there, I told the both of them what they were done. And they sort of embarrassed grins and all that sort of thing. So that was my first memory of an election. The point I wanted to make there was when Truman got reelected, I found myself, despite all my Republican reading, I found myself feeling very happy about that it wasn't Dewey. So that my inchoate class experience was stronger in me than the crap that I was filling my head with from the major media. Which luckily it's not that way anymore because the media is now free and independent and objective. I didn't go to college after high school. I graduated a couple years after that election, and my mother was dying. We had terrible medical expenses. We never heard of health insurance, and a lot of people today still haven't heard of health insurance. So I went to work. I don't want to go into all those interesting things about work and where and all that, but we don't have time. In college, I met students who were, in their own ways, just as provincial as I, but some of them had exposure to music and literature and politics, and I really began to enjoy that. I would go down to the gym on 23rd Street and box because, as I say, you know, East Harlem, if you're going to walk the streets with your head up, you had to know how to fight. And here I was in college, and I would go down, and I never tried for the team, just sparring, you know. And then after that, I would meet my girlfriend, and we would go to the Irving Berlin modern dance thing, and I would do modern dance with her and other people, and I said, boy, these are two worlds. I'm not sure I fit in either of them. I don't quite know what's going on. But it was kind of interesting to see all these kind of new and different things and to hear some of these kids talk about things, political experiences. So by then, I actively supported Adlai Stevenson in 1952. I was a liberal. I worked for the Liberal Party in New York. But I was still an anti-communist. The religion of that was still there. One of the real crucibles in my life was the civil rights movement. It was really one of the great political struggles that moved me, as it did so many other people. I would take nonviolent workshops with CORE, Congress on Racial Equality. And those were interesting experiences for me to actually sit there at a table and someone whacks you across the face or smacks you or hits you with a rolled up newspaper. And I mean, the whole different way of reacting, because you get up swinging in East Harlem and you had to not do that and just sit. And go like this, and so I can't wait till it's my turn, you know. And because we would, you know, change places and roles, and I would check out the whoever hit me the hardest got it back, you know. So you can take the kid out of Harlem, but you can't, whatever, et cetera. Now, what motivated me, I didn't know any African-Americans, or I knew a few African, I mean, some acquaintances. I had one African-American buddy in high school. We lost track of each other, though. It wasn't that I had some personal connection. It was a question of justice. It was the injustice of this racism and this separatism and this stuff, the injustice of it. I just know then and I know now that the thing I love most more than beauty or love or happiness, is justice, to see justice in the world. And that was the feeling I had. I became and I remained a liberal academic right up until the Vietnam era. I was active. I mean, I by this time I was an activist. I had gone out on the Woolworths boycotts because they weren't hiring African-American workers and trying to get people turned away. There was a number of things we did. Well, along with the civil rights movement and the anti-McCarthyism, I was right there at the height of McCarthyism, and we did fight all that stuff. Later on was the Vietnam War, and that became the other impact on me. I began to question the war, and then I began to question the leaders who produced this war, and then I began to question the system that produced these leaders. And that's when you cross the line and you say, what is this about? I demonstrated, I picketed, I blocked the draft board. Remember, a draft board center in New Haven, Connecticut, and the police grabbed me and pulled me through this hallway. One cop holding me here, one cop here. The one holding me here had his club. And he said, I'm going to kill you, you dirty communist bastard. I'm going to kill you. And the third cop was coming and hitting me in the stomach, you know, with his club. And I suddenly appreciated all that training at the boys' club and at the city college downtown. We used to have a medicine ball for boxing, you know, and you slam it into your stomach, toughen up. And so I would do that every time he hit me. And so it wasn't too bad. But threw us in the paddy wagon, and I said, wow, it's good to really firsthand experience democracy in action, you know. Yeah. During the Kent State days, we had huge demonstrations. You know, people always think, I see all those documentaries on Berkeley or Madison, Wisconsin, or sometimes Columbia. There were schools all over the country where these things were happening. Even some of the same kinds of personalities of the student leaders or faculty leaders, protesters, whatever else. And the same kind of events, the police and this and that. And you couldn't predict it. You know, it was a really remarkable, exciting time. All sorts of people. In Urbana, the fraternity guys were having special teach-ins against the war. The jocks, some of them were. It's a very interesting thing. You can't really predict. There's something about the people where they synthesize and electrify and mobilize each other and begin to do all sorts of things that weren't expected. It was in Champaign-Urbana where my academic career pretty much ended because I got beaten up by the police. We were blocking a driveway. Badly beaten. I was hit, bloodied, my whole head covered. The state troopers had clubs like this that were about that thick, and they were coming down. And one of them, they were up on the side, and one of them came right down to hit me right here on the top of the head, which would have killed me. But someone else, another trooper, hit me on the side here. That tilted my head, so his blow hit the corner of my head. And I heard this guy in the jail say, if I had gotten a good first clean lick on that guy, he'd be a dead man now. And then I heard a couple of other people standing there in civvy clothing saying, that's Parenti. Now the chancellor will want us to throw the book at him. Let's hit him with everything. Plus, when you're that badly beaten, they have to justify the beating by trumped up charges, mob action, felonious assault, blah, blah, blah. And the chancellor who wanted the book thrown at me was Jack Pelterson. When I moved out here to Berkeley, the chancellor at Cal here was Jack Pelterson. I said, am I having a recurrent nightmare? What is this about? No. So I was found guilty. They brought in state troopers who said that I had punched out this state trooper who was 6'2". So I was sentenced to 2 years in prison. What saved me was I got probation. I was already out of the state and teaching at the University of Vermont. There was a big flap there, and I'm not going to go into all the war stories, but there was a constant struggle and a constant fight. And what the system does is they attack ad hominemly. They attack the protesters. So they make the protester the issue rather than the things we're protesting. So to make that whole long story short, I've been kicked out of some of the best universities in America. I remember that I was considered a wild man by some of my academic colleagues. He's a wild man. Stop that anarchist agitation. But it wasn't that I was so wild. It was that they were so tame, I think. I realized only in retrospect that I was becoming a Marxist without having read Marx. I would say things like, I think a lot of liberals are evading the whole issue of class power. There's class power, and that class power plays a role in foreign policy. You know, I mean, this is really an imperialistic kind of thing we're looking at. And people would say, that's Marx. Whoa, that's Marx. Or I'd say, you know, I don't think the police are neutral. We always hear they're neutral, they support the law here and there. I don't think they're neutral at all. You know, you look at strikes, the police are always defending the factory against the factory worker. Why don't they favor the factory worker against the factory owners? Whoa, that's Marx. That's Marx, isn't it? And I say, you know, I don't think racism is just an attitude that people learn. It's that too, but I think it's a social force that's used and instigated and mobilized to divide people, to divide the working class. That's Marx, isn't it? That's Marx, you know? And so I started saying, this guy Marx must really be something. Whoa. Here I am knocking myself out to get an analysis, and they're giving him the credit all the time. And he's been dead for how long now? Well, as I say, I was considered a radical. I still am. But I don't think I'm so radical. It's that they're so conservative, all those other people, right? What we do know is that there are left progressive, supposedly literate intellectuals who do not see how much the dominant paradigm has seeped into their political consciousness like so much dry rot. And by the way, it's a constant struggle for all of us. All of us. We live in a political culture that is quite insidious, quite resourceful. It has propaganda, but it's not called propaganda. It has images that are paraded constantly. It has duplicity. And so we have to consciously arm ourselves against it. So I was called a wild man. I was called extremist. Is it extremist? Let me ask you the question. To want peace and social justice. You see, I have to guard against it. Some of you have to learn the English language again. The extremists are already in power. These guys are not conservatives. They are reactionaries. They are reactionaries. They are consciously... We learned that a conservative was someone who resisted change and wanted to keep his privileges and interests intact. A reactionary is someone who wanted to unturn all these things and go back to a yet more retrograde position. These guys are reactionaries. They want to bring us back to 1900. They want to destroy all the gains we made in the social net and human services. They want the conditions of labor. They want to destroy all that. They want everything for themselves. They are ruthless. Ruthless reactionaries, and they play for real, and for keeps. In 1992, I'm going to wind it down here. In 1992, the Committees of Correspondence held a convention here in Berkeley, their founding convention. It was very interesting because they were putting together a platform of what the organization would stand for, and somebody got up to the microphone and said, "You don't have anything in there about the rights of gays." And we should have something about the rights of gays. And then a woman got up and she said, "Excuse me, it should be the rights of gays and lesbians." I said, "Oh, right, that's right, right." Then a third person, I think he was a guy, he got up and we said, "No, it should be gays, lesbians, and bisexuals." And at this point, the old trade union lefty sitting behind me, he said it just loud enough for people around him to say, he said, "Yeah, how about putting something in there for the people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work?" Ladies and gentlemen, that's who I speak for. The people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work. I'm saying it allegorically. It's the people, it's all of us who are too tired for the way our society and our the good things that we want and our environment have been pulverized. The struggle is between those who want to use the world's land, labor, technology, natural resources, and markets for a capital accumulation process that increasingly enriches the few, as opposed to those who want to use these things for collective betterment, for the well-being of the many. Well, does it make any difference what we do? It makes all the difference in the world. If we did nothing, the reactionaries would have already had us back to 1900 in their program to third worldize the United States. Unless we resist and keep resisting and build our numbers, they will grind us into the dust. Does it really matter what we think or say? They ignore it anyway. They don't care what we think. Oh, they care all the time. Oh, boy, do they pay attention. Oh, boy, are they watching. They're crafting every statement they make. They're crafting and manipulating and watching all the time. They're surveilling and doing all that. They know that they stand on our shoulders, and if we ever give a collective shrug, they will be off. Ultimately, if we can change the minds of masses of people, there will be no armies for the ruling elites. There'll be no taxes. There'll be no instruments of repression. So we've got to keep fighting. I said to you I wouldn't have any Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci quotes, but I'll give you one because you've been such a nice crowd. Gramsci said, we must always have a pessimism of the mind, realize how tough and how bad things can be, but an optimism of the will. So let's have an optimism of the will, and thank you so much for your kind attention.
Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. In the debate over taxes, we hear a lot about offshore funds, the repatriation of corporate dollars, and how lowering the marginal tax rate will bring all this money pouring back and stimulate the economy. Unlikely, particularly because what we don't hear about is the almost hundreds of trillions of dollars that are hidden from view in a complex web of offshore accounts, tax havens, laundered money, corrupt banks and nations that have created a kind of alternative financial system. Back in April of 2016, leaked documents from a Panamanian law firm known as the Panama Papers began to shed light on this universal flow of tainted money. More recently, the Paradise Papers brought this corruption to the doorstep of the White House. Covering every step of it has been my guest, journalist Jake Bernstein. Jake Bernstein is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, a senior reporter on the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that originally broke the Panama Papers story, and it is my pleasure to welcome Jake Bernstein here to Radio Who, What, Why to talk about secrecy world inside the Panama Papers investigation of illicit money networks and the global elite. Jake Bernstein, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
I want to go back first to talk a little bit about the Panama Papers, what they were, and how they were leaked.
Sure. The Panama Papers ended up being well in excess of 11.5 million documents that came from a Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca. And this law firm had been, well, either leaked or hacked. The information had found its way to a German newspaper called Süddeutsche Zeitung, and they in turn gave it to a group called the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ. And ICIJ ended up sharing with it with more than 300 journalists around the world who collaborated on investigating the data and writing stories about what they found, and then all dropping their stories simultaneously on the same day in April in 2016.
It's ironic, I suppose, that it was a German publication that was the first to get this. Given if we look at the history, as you outlined it, of this law firm, Mossack Fonseca, that it has these origins and roots going all the way back to Nazi Germany.
I think that could very well be part of it. Another reason was that the Germans had gotten an earlier leak of from the law firm of a smaller subset of information and already written some stories. So I think that's part of the reason they came to the attention of the leaker, who remains anonymous. We still do not know where exactly those 11.5 million documents came from. The other thing is that the Germans have a long history of paying for this kind of information. The German government, not the media, but the German tax authorities routinely buy information about German private citizens, tax evaders, who are trying to hide their money in neighboring countries like Luxembourg or Liechtenstein. And bankers fill CDs full of information about these German account holders, cross the border, and sell it to the German government. And so there's more of a history of using this kind of data and being aware of it.
We've long known about tax havens and about offshore money. Talk a little bit about the scope of this as it's revealed in the Panama Papers.
I think you're absolutely right. We've long known about it in sort of isolated incidents and little exposés or court cases, things like that. But what this really allowed for was a macro view of this world and how it evolved over time. Mossack Fonseca formed in the mid-80s, and there are companies actually in the data that are much older than that. We found a company that went back to the 1930s. So you can really see the whole scope of this system, and Mossack Fonseca was doing business around the world, all over Latin America and Europe and Africa and everywhere in between. So you could really get a sense of how this system developed, how it morphed, the differences between different jurisdictions, how it changed over decades, and it was all available through this data.
What's fascinating in looking at the early history of Mossack Fonseca is that it sort of feels like a modern-day startup. It was a couple of guys that figured out a need, a problem that existed, and filled it in a way that gave them a kind of monopoly.
You were so right in the sense that their timing was perfect, and they had a vision, which was of a business model that was low volume, high volume, low cost, excuse me, and kind of like the McDonald's of the secrecy world. And they came up with this idea right at the time where computerization made it possible to do this kind of sort of mass, wide-scale business. And also at a time when there was incredible wealth being created in the developing world, and these new wealthy people didn't necessarily trust their countries, and they wanted to get their money out. They wanted to use these offshore companies. So they hit the moment perfectly, and the high-volume, low-cost business model worked great because when they started, really all that was required for creating an anonymous shell company was you created the company, and you didn't ask very many questions. It was, think of those monkeys, right? See nothing, hear nothing, say nothing. So you created this company, and then you stuck it in a file, and you forgot about it for a year until it was time to invoice the client to renew the company. And so you could do high volume, low cost. But what happened was over time, there started to be new vetting requirements and new due diligence requirements, but they had already released 100,000 plus companies into the wild. So as Ramon Fonseca said to me, we created this monster and then we were handed a comb and told to comb it, and it proved impossible.
Also, they created, in doing what they did, they created a level of complexity that made them, and I guess firms like them, and they really had the market cornered, essential for anyone who wanted to do business in this offshore world.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually quite widespread, this business, and they were one in the top five. There's a lot of different organizations that do it. But really, when I talk about the secrecy world, and it's not a phrase that I coined myself, it's actually a phrase that I found within the documents themselves. But we're talking about not just a system of tax havens, but we're also talking about sort of secret bank accounts in places like Singapore and Switzerland. And we're talking about the intermediaries, the registered agents who create these companies or foundations or trusts, but also lawyers and accountants and bankers that go to these intermediaries and ask for the companies on behalf of their clients. It's an entire infrastructure. And the ones who really want to, you know, do concealment, you know, there's lots of different layers. So you might have an anonymous company, but the anonymous company is owned by a foundation, and the foundation is owned by a trust. And it crosses across three different places. It's in Jersey, and it's in Panama, and it's in the British Virgin Islands. And there's lots of different steps, and you're hiding your activities with each step a little bit deeper, making it harder for law enforcement or tax authorities or business partners or your wife to find out exactly what you're doing.
Talk about the role that authoritarian leaders played in building up this business, because they took advantage of this, particularly in areas of money laundering and getting money out of various countries.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is a great insight. We saw a lot of that in the Panama Papers. I mean, say Azerbaijan is a great example, right? And so the children of the ruler of Azerbaijan have property all over the country, all over the world, you know, in London and different places like that, in Switzerland and Monaco. And they also have monopolies of certain key industries inside the country. But they need to get that money out of Azerbaijan, and so they use these offshore companies to do that. One of the most sort of interesting insights that we gleaned from the Panama Papers was we found heretofore unknown anonymous shell companies around, you know, with people around Vladimir Putin, including the godfather of Putin's eldest daughter, a musician, a classical musician named Sergei Roldugin, who had nobody even knew was a businessman, but he was ostensibly the owner of several offshore companies that were doing incredibly complex and very interesting and high-dollar business activities. So this is a system that is used by rulers to deflect what they're actually doing. In some cases, is robbing the states that they control.
How aware did Mossack Fonseca need to be in terms of being up to date on political nuance in the world? And to what extent were they reacting to, and to what extent were they influencing some of that as it relates to offshore funds?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I mean, they were very cognizant of different rules, you know, of different activities by different powers to try to curtail this business. And they were part of a global movement to fight back against that. So, for example, the organization of the OECD, right, the organization of, I can't even remember the full title of it, but it's the group of developing nations that tries to sort of create rules for trade and other things. They try to curtail some of this business, you know, rein in the tax havens. And Mossack Fonseca was part of a group of tax havens and intermediaries and others, including certain libertarian Washington-based think tanks that really launched a campaign to try to stop the OECD from reining in this business. So they were very cognizant of that kind of thing. And then they also were very aware of how this – I mean, this is a system that evolves. It's almost an organic creature, right? So one of the big offerings that they had for a long time was something called bearer shares. And bearer shares are kind of fascinating because it's essentially a certificate, a piece of paper, and whoever holds the piece of paper owns the company. So prosecutors and governments hate this because it's ideal for money launderers. You know, I can give you a piece of paper and suddenly you own the company, and the company can hold an asset, and I can move assets around without anybody knowing about it. So systematically, countries started to either restrict or outlaw completely bearer shares. The BVI was one of the early ones to do that, the British Virgin Islands. And when they did that, you can see a spike in company incorporations in Panama, which still allowed these bearer shares. And so I think Mossack Fonseca was very aware of how this system evolved and moved around from place to place so that they could continue selling this kind of secrecy.
Beyond money laundering and even illegally moving money out of these countries by authoritarian leaders, one of the other areas that was part of this was the degree to which illicit activity was part of what the money was used for. It appears that so much of this money was either used for or came from things like illegal drug dealing and human trafficking. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Now, we have to say that this system can be used legally, right? And even though one of the Mossack Fonseca lawyers said in an email, sort of in a moment of private candor, that almost 95% of what they do is helping their customers legally avoid taxes, there was a huge amount of criminality that was also involved. And we found, you know, Mexican cartels and Russians who were involved. So they literally had boats where they were treating people who they had dragooned into being sailors as actual slaves. And then we saw a tremendous number of scamsters and Ponzi schemers, you know, where it seems like after Bernie Madoff, you know, did his massive fraud in the United States, every major fraud in every country had their own sort of mini Madoff. So you see a number of them in the Panama Papers. There was the Argentinian Madoff, for example, and he was running his scam through anonymous offshore companies that were bought through Mossack Fonseca. So there were all kinds of things like that. And again, it was the anonymity and the lack of transparency that allowed them to do this.
To what extent did tax authorities around the world, including the Internal Revenue Service, try and track all this down or do anything about it?
My goodness, that's a good question. There's a chapter in my book, Secrecy World, about this extraordinary IRS agent named Joe West, who was sort of given a task of actually researching how this world functioned and coming up with a menu of ideas of how they could go after Americans who were using tax havens to evade taxes. And he came up with a whole bunch of good ideas, and the IRS ended up doing one of them and had some success with it. But Joe West was so frustrated by the bureaucracy and by the resistance that he encountered within the agency that he ends up sort of retiring early and giving up on the whole thing. I mean, the IRS, in their defense, has been savagely cut back by the Republican Congress. They do not have the resources that they need. It's very hard to break through the secrecy behind these intermediaries and these tax havens. They do not give up information willingly. The IRS is a little bit worried about attorney-client privilege, you know, when there are lawyers involved in this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of obstacles. It takes great resources for governments to break through it, to track this information. And they really need leaks and whistleblowers and things like that, and those things don't come along every day. So it's been a big challenge for governments to get their hands around it.
What impact, if any, have the Panama Papers had in curtailing any of this activity?
Well, I mean, there's been hundreds of investigations and criminal inquiries that have been launched around the world over this stuff. And then there's been, you know, direct political fallout in different places. The Prime Minister of Iceland was forced to resign when it was revealed that he had a secret company that Icelandic voters didn't know about. The President of Pakistan was removed from office because his family was using offshore companies to buy property in London, and sort of hard to explain where the money came from. The Minister of Industry for Spain was also forced to resign. There's been political repercussions in a number of places, and then there have been open investigations and prosecutions out of this. And it also, I think, has raised awareness about how this system works. As you sort of said so eloquently in the beginning, I mean, this is this massive shadow economy. You know, trillions of dollars are flowing through it, And most people are not aware of it, even though we live with the impacts in soaring property prices in places like New York and Miami and Los Angeles, and in taxes that aren't paid for health care and infrastructure and education and police and stuff like that. But we don't really know how this system works. And these leak investigations have given us a window into it that we otherwise wouldn't have.
Talk a little bit about the subsequent release and leaking of what were called the Paradise Papers, what they were, and how they were sort of the next step in learning more about this story.
Well, the Paradise Papers came from a law firm called Appleby, primarily, which is based in Bermuda. And Appleby was very different from Mossack Fonseca in that they were smaller and they were more exclusive. So they handled a lot of corporate clients like Nike and Apple. They had a lot more Americans, more than 30,000, I think, were American customers. And what they were doing was generally more legal, more above board, but had in some ways the same impact. You know, they allowed, you know, help their customers avoid, you know, billions of dollars in taxes. But you see a lot more sort of high-dollar Americans, both Democrats and Republicans, all kinds of business stripes. So the Appleby kind of gives us a different perspective. They were not as freewheeling as the Panamanians. The Panamanians were much more open and loquacious on email. Appleby was more guarded and more careful. But it gave us sort of a different perspective on how this world works.
Talk a little bit about Panama and why it became the epicenter of so much of this.
You know, Panama's incorporation law was passed, I think, in the 1920s, or maybe even before. Maybe it was around 1919. They cribbed their company incorporation law from Delaware, among other U.S. states. They sort of copied it, and originally it was about shipping. You know, they were pushing Panama as because of the canal as an idea for, you know, where people could register ships. And get away from the kind of regulation and oversight that people had if they tried to register their ships in the United States. And from there, it sort of morphed into, you know, companies for reasons other than ships. And it really sort of took off during the dictatorship of Trujillo, you know, where he kind of opened up the country for money launderers and for drug traffickers and the banking system and offshore anonymous companies, and it sort of grew from there.
One of the things you write about is the degree to which all of this money played such a critical role in both Russia in particular with respect to Putin and in China. Tell us a little about that.
Well, this is, you know, interesting in that, again, it's sort of legal, right, in many cases, you know, a sort of workaround. You know, Russians, for example, have been offshoring now for quite a bit. You know, there was a bit of a land rush with the fall of communism, and people were involved in all kinds of businesses, some legitimate, some not so much, and they wanted to legitimize these overnight fortunes, and they also are somewhat distrustful of their government. The rule of law is shaky at best in Russia, and so people get their money out if they can. And there's been a huge drain. I mean, Putin himself sort of ironically has castigated Russians for moving their money offshore. And China is sort of another example of this. China sort of embraces capitalism, but their system of government and their business system doesn't quite catch up with the entrepreneurial fervor that is unleashed, and so they need a workaround, and the workaround is this offshore system, and it's sort of the government kind of knows it and turns a blind eye to it, and in some cases encourages it. It allows you, say, if you want to import machinery into China, it can be very difficult, right? But if you have an offshore company that is created to buy the machinery, and then you are a foreign subsidiary instead of an actual Chinese person importing that machinery into China, it's just easier to do. And so this happened all around the developing world, where you know, they had archaic rules or they had corrupt governments. And it allowed the citizens to sort of sidestep a lot of that by creating these companies in tax havens. And it also allowed them to avoid paying taxes. And in many cases, if their financial wherewithal was coming from corruption, it allowed them to hide their crimes.
To what extent are the rules constantly changing, and how important is it for those that are doing this with money around the world to really have the resources of people like Mossack and Fonseca to really fully understand the changing landscape?
That is a fantastic question, because this system is constantly evolving. And one of the things that has changed, and I think the Panama Papers is part of that change, is the bar to entry has risen a bit, because the requirements are greater now, you know, for vetting clients and things like that. And you have to go further afield to get the absolute secrecy that people wanted. What Mossack Fonseca was really trying to do was make this available to the merely rich. And now I think it's become a little bit more exclusive. It's now more the province of the uber wealthy, you know, the truly wealthy. So that has been one of the changes. The other change, I think, is that there have been other avenues where people go. So whereas the British Virgin Islands was a place that a lot of people created companies, they've gotten a little bit tighter on their demands for due diligence. And so people have moved to places like Dubai or Singapore, or money laundering has embraced Bitcoin, because it offers the kind of secrecy and lack of transparency that is tightened up a bit in the offshore world.
What role, if any, has technology played in making all of this possible? Because there's a kind of creative destruction side to all of this.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think technology has made it available in a way that was not, you know, possible before. You know, this is one of the things that the Mossack Fonseca really prided themselves on. You know, they felt like they were cutting edge as far as technology was concerned, and they really tried to systematize their business. And it also allowed them to do things like they created their own personal tax haven in a Pacific island called Niue, which is a spit of sand with 500 inhabitants, and they created their own Mossack Fonseca tax haven out of Niue, but the tax haven was actually run out of their offices in Panama. So if you wanted a Niue company, you contacted them, and they had all of the templates and the information. The deputy registrar of the Niue ministry that created companies was a Mossack Fonseca employee, and he had a stamp, and you hit print, and it, you know, you, once you got the name and the company number, it just kicked out a company in less than an hour. And you can only really do that when you have computerization. So I think it was a big factor in making this world much more accessible.
And is there any reason to think that this sunlight, this exposure to all of this, is going to do anything to curtail this or just chase it somewhere else?
Boy, that's a good question. I think that the only thing is that's going to curtail this or reform it will be an act of citizenry. You know, people in places like Europe and the United States who recognize that there is a connection to their lives. You know, that the tax evasion has a direct connection to, you know, the services they receive and what's available for them. You know, and that idea that there's now a transnational class of people who are not bound by the rules that we are bound by, that most people are bound by, you know, that they have apartments all over the world and bank accounts all over the world, and they're, you know, even though they might make their money in the United States, they don't feel obligated to pay taxes here or pay very, you know, input into society. So I think that the key thing is these leaks have sort of pulled back the curtain, and we can see how this business works, and we can see the effects of it. And so hopefully, you know, citizens will start to demand that there's more accountability and more transparency. And that's the only way it really changes.
Jake Bernstein, his book is Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Jake, I thank you so much for spending time with us here today on Radio Who, What, Why.
No, thank you, Jeff. It's been great.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and for joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.